landlords and tenants trust Authority Property Management at 2663 Victor Avenue. They manage a variety of properties, including single-family homes, apartments, condos, townhouses, multifamily properties, and commercial properties. Authority Property Management offers full-time management, including finding and screening tenants, rent collection, financial reporting, and final walkthrough home inspections when they move out. Contact Authority Property Management today at 530-410-6085 and check out their website at authoritypm.com.
Hello, Northern California. This is Rollin with the Flag Center. With fire season clearly upon us, we're inviting you to join us in celebrating all police, firefighters, and first responders who keep us safe day and night through thick and thin. We salute you. The Flag Center keeps plenty of thin blue line and thin red line flags in stock. To get yours, stop by the Flag Center at 2124 Hilltop Drive or on the web at theflagcenter.com. Flags, flagpoles, and accessories since 1980.
Hey, and welcome. This is the Ben Shapiro Show. I recently had the opportunity to sit down with my friend Avishal Garg. He's an expert on crypto, Bitcoin, and AI. It's a fascinating conversation. Give it a listen.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, your specialty is the crypto world and crypto. So for people who have like no background in crypto, what is it? How does it work? Why is it important?
Yeah, so it depends how far you want to go down the rabbit hole, but crypto, well, the old school version of crypto is just cryptography. And all that is math that lets you secure data and prove facts about the world. And it's actually really important to the internet in general. It's why we can do things like credit cards on the internet. That's cryptography. Crypto, as it's become to be known over the last decade, is really how do you use cryptography and distributed systems really to move money around and do new kinds of computation. And so this really started with Bitcoin circa 2009, and that sort of kicked off what we call the modern crypto. And that came out of an observation or a political belief that the legacy financial systems were messed up and broken. And so if people go back to 2008, the economy was falling apart. The banks had sort of done a bunch of things that they shouldn't have been doing. And so there was a computer scientist or a scientist by the name of Satoshi, who was a sort of a pen name, and they published a white paper articulating how you might do peer-to-peer cash without the need for a bank in the middle. And so how could I transfer money and transfer value to somebody else without without a bank in the middle? And it actually was a combination of both computer science, like legitimate technology breakthroughs, and some really interesting social design. And kind of the fundamental thing that they did as a trade-off, they said, well, the legacy systems are really designed around efficiency. And what if instead of saying, I'm going to optimize for efficiency, I optimize for security? And so you optimize for things like self-sovereignty. I'm going to own my own data. And I don't want to trust an intermediary. And so rather than trusting these banks, I choose to not trust them. Could I do the same things? Could I actually move my money around? And it turns out you can. And it was kind of a crazy idea. It was published anonymously. A white paper was put out. Some code, open source code was put out. And it started to take off, and you know, here we are almost 15 years later, and that core sort of insight around Bitcoin is now almost a $1 trillion asset. There's been a whole sort of explosion of other crypto assets around that, and cryptocurrencies and crypto projects around that. That whole ecosystem is worth, you know, somewhere around $2 trillion at this point. And so, you know, a lot has evolved over the last 15 years, but kind of the core original insight was, what if I wanted to do things and I don't trust these intermediaries anymore? Which I think touches on a lot of sort of things that people have really started to feel over the last 5 or 10 years in particular. But this was sort of the computer scientist version of, if I want to do the things I wanted to do before, how would I do them without trusting any intermediaries?
So you can certainly see why established institutions would not like this, because it's quite disruptive. If you're the banking industry and you're used to people using you for those mechanisms of exchange no longer that's being used, you're not going to like that. If you're a government, you might not particularly like it, because you've been in charge of the monetary supply. And now when you're looking at something like Bitcoin, it has its own established value, a value established by the market. I want to get to sort of the institutional opposition to Bitcoin and to crypto generally. But first, what do you think that crypto has become? So there's a lot of talk early on about wide adoption of crypto as a mechanism of exchange, as opposed to a second property of it, which is a repository of value. That basically it's like digital gold. I'm hedging against inflation in the economy. And so I buy a bunch of gold, I put it in my safe, and, you know, a year from now it's worth more money. Some people have used Bitcoin like that, but there are obviously other uses for crypto. Yeah. what are the various uses for crypto?
Yeah, so what it's really become is sort of from that original insight of potentially the ability to move money around, I think people started to say, well, actually, this is just a new computational infrastructure. What it really does is, you know, like if you look at Amazon or Facebook or Google, they really built their entire infrastructure around speed and efficiency and scalability. And so you got massive centralization, which you see on the internet. You got these intermediaries like Facebook or Google or Amazon that sort of concentrated all of the users and concentrated all of the money and all the power. And it's partly an outgrowth of what the infrastructure lets you do. So the way the internet was designed, you sort of got this necessary centralization effect, because scale sort of makes things more efficient. In this world, if you start from an assumption of, well, what if I don't want centralization? What if I don't want to trust my counterparty? And what if I'm willing to trade off some efficiency to get these sorts of properties? You sort of start from a different premise. And so the infrastructure has grown in a different way. And Bitcoin was just the first application, this idea of a non-sovereign store of value. Almost like a digital gold. And as that sort of started to take off, people started to say, well, you know, what if you could write code around this? What if it's not just about transferring the value, but what if I could, because, you know, as soon as the money becomes ones and zeros, ones and zeros is just, you know, a thing that a computer can recognize. And so what if you wrote code around that? And so starting in about 2015, with Ethereum, people started to say, well, if I can write code around money, I can now program money. And when you start thinking about a lot of the world, a lot of the infrastructure of the world, whether it's wills or trusts or escrow agreements, if you bought a house, or insurance, securities, derivatives, like what are all of these things? Fundamentally, what they are is here's a pile of resources, here's a pile of money, and I have some rules around who can access that money, and I have some rules around what happens over time with that money. There's cash flows that come off of it, or you know, in the event of my passing, something needs to happen with this pile of resources. And now, instead of all of that being written in legal documents, we could write it in code. We could write it in software. And that insight sort of kicked off an entirely new sort of, you know, arm and branch of what's known as crypto today, that started to explore this idea of what would it look like if you could write code that owned money and operated around money. And so now the kinds of use cases that you're starting to see that have really taken off are, for example, stable coins. And this is the idea that actually a lot of the world wants to transact US dollars. And it's quite painful to do that. If anybody's actually... You know, the example we always use is if you wanted to get money from, let's say, San Francisco to London, and it's Friday afternoon, you are actually better off going to the bank, pulling out $20,000, putting it into a briefcase, buying a flight, getting on a plane, and going to London and then handing somebody the suitcase. Because if you send a wire, it's not going to get there till Tuesday, right? The banks are closed on the weekends. They don't settle wires. It'll take a, you know, T+1 to settle on Monday. And so maybe the money shows up on Tuesday, and you could actually have the money in a suitcase there, you know, Friday night or Saturday morning. And that's kind of crazy, right? In 2025 almost here, there are very few parts of the world where atoms actually move faster than bits, and money continues to be one of them. And so now you can actually send money via USD stablecoins, and it's 24/7. It shows up instantly. It shows up in somebody's wallet, and then they can off-ramp it back to their bank account when the bank's open. But it's actually the best, fastest, cheapest way to move US dollars in the world now. And so you're seeing on the order of about $1 trillion a quarter of money movement happening with this stuff. And for a lot of sort of international use cases, so you're seeing, for example, a lot of remittance volume start to go through stablecoins in the Gulf or in Southeast Asia, where a lot of people want dollars and they can't get access to dollars. And there are large populations of people in the West from those markets. And it's just a better way to do business. I mean, like we use this for investing in startups because we can just send money, you know, over the weekend after you invest in a company. And so you're starting to see now businesses start to look at this and adopt this as one of the novel and interesting things. And so once you realize that you can actually, you know, money is digital and you can write code around money, it opens up this whole new universe of, well, what are all the things that were technology built in the 1970s, and we can do those things in a drastically different way today. And so you're starting to see new emerging use cases even beyond just the basic sort of US dollar money movement into things like lending, into things like stable swaps, so like Forex sorts of use cases, like really sort of base infrastructure that we haven't really had to think about since maybe World War II, you know, Bretton Woods and in the 1950s, where we invented a lot of this infrastructure. But we're reimagining it now with 2024 computer science, which is just faster, cheaper, better, more scalable.
So, I mean, all of this sounds pretty amazing, and yet there's tremendous regulatory heartburn over all of this. So, yeah. You know, to sort of steel man the regulatory worries, what exactly are people most worried about that they are now suggesting there needs to be a heavy regulatory regime around some of the use cases or around the original technology?
Yeah, so the backdrop here, so I think it's important to also contextualize this globally. So it turns out the U.S. is a bit of an outlier in this. Actually, most of the world is very, very happy to have these technologies. And I think it's an interesting history lesson, which is if you go back to the 90s and the U.S. internet, you know, this Section 230 that sort of happens, and it was, you know, part of the Telco Act of 96. And it was a really, really important piece of legislation, because what it did was it opened the door to the internet, the modern internet as we know it. And really what it said was, you know what, these technologies are a little bit different. They're not exactly like newspapers that have editorial staff and you can sort of control these things in the way that you did the newspapers. We've got to think about these rules differently. And so, for example, it set aside rules that said, well, you know, if you're a digital forum, like a Facebook or YouTube, you have different rules than a newspaper might have. And actually, like, if you, you know, as a media person, you don't need to go to the FTC to get a media license, a radio license to publish on the internet. And so these sort of basic ground rules understood that the technology was different in some fundamental ways. And so we needed some new rules to account for how it was different. That ushered in the modern internet. Like, the reason America won the internet was because some of these rules were put in place in the late 90s. And so we got Amazon, we got Facebook, we got YouTube, and we got Google and all the sort of mega tech companies. Now, the rest of the world looked at this and today has a set of challenges. Like, if you're Europe, if you're, you know, Brazil, if you're India, if you're China, you're looking at these things and you're saying they're so important in society as sort of fundamental pieces of infrastructure, but you have zero leverage over them. Like, you know, if you want to call in one of the CEOs of these companies and you're Europe, are the CEOs going to come? No, they're American. They're American citizens. They're in America. Like, they're subject to U.S. law. They will abide by most of these laws in these other places, but you have relatively little leverage actually over these companies, because fundamentally they're American companies. So it's a tremendous national security asset that these ended up being American companies. So now the rest of the world looked at this and said, oh, we kind of lost the internet. We don't want to repeat that mistake. And so if you look at what the rest of the world is doing around things like crypto or AI, they're really leaning into it. And what they're trying to do is figure out, how do we make these companies successful in our domestic markets? Because if we can do that, we'll actually, in the long term, have leverage. And we won't be beholden to these American companies over whom we have no leverage. So actually, the rest of the world has gone very pro-crypto. UK, Germany, Singapore, many of these markets are actually embracing it and leaning into the technology. They're giving visas to people. Dubai, they're giving visas to people to come build these companies. The United States, on the other hand, I think we learned some wrong lessons, which is, because we were the beneficiary, it's almost like a resource curse. We sort of won the internet, and we forgot in many ways why we won, and we sort of take it for granted, and how powerful these entities are and how important they are from an economic perspective and a national security perspective. And so we're kind of botching it a little bit. And so there's a lot of sort of dragging of feet. There's a lot of opposition. There's a lot of fear about what these things might do, rather than sort of optimism about how amazing things could be. And so the U.S. is a bit of an outlier. And specifically in the U.S., a lot of the concern fundamentally comes down to, in my opinion, a philosophical concern, which is, who gets to control these things? And I think from a government perspective, you know, the legacy financial system and a lot of these computational companies like an Amazon or a Google, well, you can call the CEO. You can have them come testify. You can yell at them. You can get your PR moment, or you can find them. How do you do that with a decentralized crypto network? How do you really think about that? And the reality is, you can't. There's no who you're going to come yell at about Bitcoin. You can't. And even if you could, there's nothing they can do about it, right? The code is open source and it's running and it's autonomous. And this presents a real challenge, I think. And we don't really have a great framework for how to think about that. I think the last time, in my opinion, that we had to think about these kinds of issues was frankly like the invention of the LLC, like in the 1850s. So if you go back and look at the history of limited liability corporations, we invented, is actually a fantastic technological breakthrough, something like the Dutch East India Company, which said, let's pool a bunch of capital and we'll go pursue this venture. And that charter, you had to go get that charter from the king. So the king would give you a charter to start a corporation, and you could pool assets and then go pursue risk opportunities. And it was really a separation of sort of capital risk from the people pursuing that with their skills. It took about 150 or 200 years, but a lot of people started to say, well, wait a second, why do you need to go to the king to talk about these things? Like, why can't I just start a company? And so around 1850 in the UK and the US, we created really simple ways for people to create corporations. And it's actually really fascinating. If you go back and look at some of the debates that were happening at the time, there were really interesting questions like, well, you know, are these things people? Like, do they have rights? What happens if there is a fire and somebody dies? Like, who's liable? Is it the owner of the thing, or is it the company, or who pays? Will these things have free speech rights? Will they be able to, like, participate in elections? What does that mean? Will they have too much power and money? And there are, like, actually a lot of really interesting questions that were surfaced at the time. But what we said was, you know what, this is a useful new technological construct, and so let's create some rules around things like corporations and LLCs. And that was a really big breakthrough, because that was a big part of what allowed things like railroads or the Industrial Revolution, because now you could aggregate capital to pursue opportunities at a scale that you just previously could not. And that sort of fundamental set of questions of like, how does this work and what are the rules? People had to really sit down and think about things like liability and ownership, free speech rights and all these things. We haven't really had to face that for 150 years. We are now faced with a similar set of questions here around, well, these are decentralized networks. There isn't a CEO that you can just call. So how does liability work? How does free speech work? Like if I can write code and just put it on the internet, isn't that free speech? What happens if something goes wrong? How do we think about things like KYC and anti-money laundering? And how do we prevent terrorist financing? There's some really fundamental questions here that we need to sort of sort through. I don't think the answer is to just say no, because the reality is that that's not an answer because this stuff is happening globally now. And so I think the U.S. has actually sort of dragged its feet and there's been a lot of opposition, but I think it's actually to the detriment of the U.S. to not have, people thinking about these questions and trying to answer them.
More of my friend Avi Shalgar coming up is the Ben Shapiro Show.
Hi, this is Chuck Kenny, owner of Shasta Gas Propane. 27 years ago, my wife Judy and I started Shasta Gas with the help and under the direction of the Lord Jesus Christ. In fact, we believe He is the owner and we are simply the managers. Through the years, we have received many offers from major national corporations to buy Shasta Gas, but our commitment has always been to be and remain locally owned and family operated. Our daughter Karen Wehunt and her husband Jason now manage the daily operations of Shasta Gas and Shasta Tanks, a new business we started a few years ago. We now have the third generation of family members working in the business. Sunshine Stevens, our granddaughter, and her husband Adam, and our grandson Jason. Our commitment and motto are still the same. Our customers are warm friends. To support locally owned family operated business, please call Shasta Gas Propane at 530-365-3793. That's 530-365-3793.
Looking for a unique gift this Christmas? Memory Lane Antiques, Vintage and Collectibles in the Shasta Gateway Center on Highway 273 in Anderson has distinct treasures to choose from, including Christmas decorations, vinyl records, DVDs, vintage toys, and antique jewelry, such as brooches and rings, necklaces and bracelets. Memory Lane Antiques, Vintage and Collectibles also offers vintage clothing and accessories, such as retro dresses and scarves, jackets and hats, along with vintage furniture, tablecloths and silverware, cookware, and glassware. And don't forget Mantiques, including military memorabilia, camping and mining equipment, men's jewelry such as crosses and rings, sports memorabilia, and collectibles. Come find that perfect gift this Christmas at Memory Lane Antiques, Vintage, and Collectibles in the Shasta Gateway Center on Highway 273 in Anderson. Open Monday 10 to 6, closed Tuesday and Wednesday. Open Thursday through Saturday from 10 to 6, and Sunday noon to 5.
Riverfront Playhouse presents Gaslight Theater's Christmas Vacation by Katherine Burns and Mike Urema, with musical arrangements by Josh Lamoureux, directed by Aaron Stewart. See this delightful musical comedy set in a small town where Mark Grimsworth aims to create the ultimate Christmas for his family while maintaining his streak in the annual Holiday Lights contest. Tickets available at riverfrontplayhouse.net. Gaslight Theater's Christmas Vacation, November 29th through December 15th. Sponsored by this station and these pro arts businesses.
Cornerstone Community Bank is proud to partner with KCNR for Operation Holiday Salute. We'd like to express our heartfelt gratitude to veterans and active duty service members for their dedication and sacrifice. Cornerstone Community Bank offers personal and business banking solutions tailored to fit your unique needs. We invite you to experience the warmth of banking with us. Visit one of our four branches in Reading, Anderson, or Red Bluff, or online at bankcornerstone.com. Cornerstone Community Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Five.
Welcome back. This is the Ben Shapiro Show. So I recently had the opportunity to sit down with my friend Avi Shalgar, an expert on AI, crypto, Bitcoin. Fascinating conversation. Here's what it sounded like.
So when you look at sort of the current regulators and the regulatory environment, give me some examples of some badly thought out legislation or badly thought out regulation. Obviously, if you spend any time in this world at all, even like me, sort of casually, the name Gary Gensler comes up a lot.
Yeah.
They're regulators who are widely disliked in sort of these communities, in the crypto community, for being heavy-handed, for believing that you can sort of put the genie back in the bottle. What does bad regulation look like? What are the problems?
Yeah, well, bad regulation is actually no regulation. It's regulation by enforcement. And so there's no legislation. And so what we really need are clarity of the rules. And it's pretty crazy. I've never worked in a space that is demanding legislation the way that the crypto industry is. Like, people go to senators and congresspeople and I'm like, please regulate us. Like, tell us what the rules are because we want to follow the rules. Because in the absence of these rules, what you really end up doing is empowering the bad actors, right? What you end up doing is the people who are willing to skirt the law, who are not willing to spend time working with the regulators or the legislators to figure this stuff out, are the ones who just go off and start, you know, doing scammy things, and then people ultimately lose their money. And so, for example, if you look at, you know, the really famous example of this from a few years ago is FTX, which is, you know, sort of an American company. It was a bunch of American founders, but they moved to the Bahamas to run their business. And so it looked like an American company, but in practice was not an American company. It was not regulated by the United States. They were not subject to disclosure rights in the U.S. But a lot of people trusted them because they looked like an American company. And it ended up being a $10 billion fraud, and Sam Bankman-Fried is going to jail and so on. But that's a perfect example of the lack of legislation and clarity creates the opportunity for these sorts of bad actors to come in and exploit the system. Meanwhile, the good actors are trying to figure out how to comply, and it's unclear how to do that. And so when it comes to some of these agencies, what you really see happening is that they are taking this ambiguity and in the absence of clarity from the legislators are essentially deciding the rules and dictating those rules. And sometimes those rules are applied arbitrarily and capriciously. These are literally words that judges would use. And a handful of companies that have the resources are now taking the SEC to court and winning. And it's actually pretty remarkable. I mean, for anybody who's studied the history of the agency model and Chevron and sort of these recent rulings that have happened, it's pretty fascinating because historically, you know, if the SEC gave you a Wells notice or said, we're taking you to court, their hit rate was so good. They were so trusted. Like, your stock would tank if you got a Wells notice. These days, because they've taken such a different strategy of issuing Wells notices and frankly losing in court multiple times, the market just doesn't even take that seriously anymore, which is a real, I think, hit to the credibility of the agency at the end of the day. And so what's happened is we actually don't have legislation. We don't have regulatory clarity. The agencies are trying to do this through enforcement. And then when it goes to court, they're in many cases losing. And that's just an extremely expensive way to run an industry. And so this is why the industry is going to, you know, there are many great legislators on both sides, on Democrats and Republicans. You know, Senator Gillibrand from New York. You have Richie Torres from New York on the Dem side. You have Ro Khanna here from California. You have Patrick McHenry, who's the chair of the House Financial Services Committee. You know, you have people who are trying to push this forward. But that's what we ultimately need, is we need some sort of legislation to start clarifying what the rules actually are and actually telling the agencies what the rules are, because in the absence of that, the agencies are sort of are you know, taking this into their own hands.
So you mentioned economic growth and innovation. Obviously, the area that's seen tremendous amounts of investment right now is in AI. So let's talk about AI. I think sure. A lot of people very, very nervous about AI, about what it's going to do.
Yeah.
Now, there's sort of the tech optimist view, which is it's an amazing new technology. It's going to allow for innovation at a level that we've never seen before, because essentially at a certain point you are going to reach artificial general intelligence, which means effectively, why don't you define it? I don't want to misdefine it. So why don't you define what artificial general intelligence is?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because AGI sort of has a couple of different flavors of it. I think one version of it is, well, there's another test that we talk about, which is the Turing test, but AGI, generally the way people will describe it is, for an arbitrary task, this software could perform as well as an arbitrary human. So, you know, an average typical human. Now there's a lighter weight version of that that you might say, well, for some universe of tasks, will this outperform? So it's not universal in the sense that, you know, a human is very good at learning how to drive a car and ride a bicycle and also do their taxes and also learn email and learning software. And so maybe you don't get AGI that is necessarily good at doing all of those things, but you might have some sort of human level intelligence that for certain types of tasks it does as well as human. I think we're more likely to be able to get that level of intelligence relatively quickly. The broader, like, it can learn anything with very limited data. You know, humans are phenomenal with a couple of data points. You know, like, you can teach a 4-year-old how to ride a bike in a couple of hours. It's pretty remarkable that we can do that. That I think is some time away. And so if you define AGI that way, that's probably many years away. If you define AGI as for certain types of intellectual tasks it will do as well as a typical human, I think that's on the order of like 2 years away.
More of my friend Avi Shalgar coming up. This is the Ben Shapiro Show.
Get ready, rodeo fans. From December 4th to the 7th, we're bringing you live coverage straight from the National Finals Rodeo.
Tune in as we go behind the scenes with exclusive interviews featuring contestants, stock contractors, and even the president of the PRCA.
Whether you're a diehard fan or just love the excitement of the rodeo, you won't want to miss a second of the show.
Join us live from the National Finals Rodeo, December 4th through 7th from 7 to 9 a.m.
Brought to you by the Reading Rodeo Association and Reading Rancheria, bucking by the river.
Looking for work? O2 Employment Services has been working with local job seekers for the past 20 years. If you're tired of uploading your resume and getting no response, it's time to let O2 help you find that perfect position. Oh, and by the way, you pay absolutely nothing for our service. If you'd like our help, head on over to our website at o2es.com, click apply now, and complete our online application. We have connections with over 600 local businesses. Once we have your information and understand what you're looking for, we can introduce you to all the positions you may wish to consider. We currently have over 100 available positions, and we would love to match you with the one you're looking for. O2 Employment Services, the North State's leading staffing agency. Give us a call at 530-223-4674. That's 530-223-4674. Or visit us online at o2es.com.
Looking for the freshest top-shelf flower? Look no further than the Queen of Dragons in the city of Shasta Lake, where they work directly with small, local farmers to bring you the finest flower that fits your price. The Queen of Dragons has the best prices on carts, edibles, concentrates, and pre-rolls. Plus, don't miss happy hour every day from 6 p.m. until close and all day Sundays. Don't just stock up on toilet paper. The Queen of Dragons has great deals, so you can stock up on the best flower for the best prices. So what are you waiting for? Stop by Queen of Dragons at 5044 Shasta Dam Boulevard or call 530-238-5638 for details or delivery. That's 530-238-5638. And don't forget to follow Queen of Dragons on Facebook and X at the Queen Dragons for all the latest deals and updates. Support Queen of Dragons, a local business in the city of Shasta Lake, where you will find the most friendly and knowledgeable staff. Queen of Dragons at 5044 Shasta Dam Boulevard. Visit queenofdragons.com or follow us on X at the Queen Dragons.
At Greg's Pump and Well Service, we believe integrity is the cornerstone of everything we do. This month, we proudly salute our armed forces and first responders, those who embody true service, dedication, and integrity. When you choose us for your pump and well needs, you're choosing a company that shares those same values. Thank you for your service. Let us serve you with pride. 530-282-5395. Call us at 530-282-5395, license 109-0355.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
Riverfront Playhouse presents Gaslight Theater's Christmas Vacation by Catherine Burns and Mike Urema, with musical arrangements by Josh Lamoureux, directed by Aaron Stewart. See this delightful musical comedy set in a small town where Mark Grinsworth aims to create the ultimate Christmas for his family while maintaining his streak in the annual Holiday Lights contest. Tickets available at riverfrontplayhouse.net. Gaslight Theater's Christmas Vacation, November 29th through December 15th. Sponsored by this station and these pro arts businesses.
What is happening in the state of Jefferson? To find out, listen to the Jefferson State of Mind program Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KCNR with your hosts Wayne Carpenter and Terry Raposa. To catch up on past broadcasts or to listen anytime, go to KCNR1460.com and click on the archives link.
ACA, come out and play. Have you seen the bill? We all have to pay. The time has come for 51 in a Jefferson state of mind.
Hey, and welcome. This is the Ben Shapiro Show. I recently had the opportunity to sit down with my friend Avishal Garg. He's an expert on crypto, Bitcoin, and AI. It's a fascinating conversation. Give it a listen.
Yeah, so when we get to the second order effects, which is, I think, what people are mostly worried about, the societal effects of what happens when, you know, half the population, at least in the temporary term, hasn't adjusted yet to the shift. Because, as you mentioned, if you look at the history of American economic growth, there have been a number of industries where it used to represent a huge percentage of the workforce and now represents a tiny percentage of the workforce, and people moved into other jobs. But there is this lag effect. I mean, America used to be a heavily agricultural economy. Yeah. It was a heavy manufacturing-based economy. Now it's a heavy service economy. And so when that, you know, is taken over by AI, when AI is doing a lot of those tasks, what do you think is the sort of next thing that human beings are still going to be better at than machines? Like, presumably there will be a cadre of experts in every field who will still be better than the machines are, because they'll be the geniuses who are, you know, if you're a Nobel Prize winning nuclear physicist and you have a bunch of grad level students who are working for you, but they're all AIs.
Yeah.
It wipes out the grad level students. It doesn't necessarily wipe out the nuclear level, the Nobel Prize winning nuclear physicist. But, you know, if you're not that guy, if you're everybody else, which is, you know, 98% of the population, what exactly do you think is left for those people to do?
Yeah, I think a lot of it will become human-to-human interactions. So there are certain things that humans ultimately will still want human interfaces for. So, for example, going to the doctor. So an AI is going to be better at diagnosing you. AI is already better at diagnosing than most doctors today. But there's something fundamentally human about going to the doctor's office and having somebody talk to you and listen to you. That doesn't go away. And so the modality of how you do your job in a lot of human-to-human interactions will change pretty fundamentally, and we'll have to retrain a bunch of people on how to use these tools properly. But I think what you'll see is anything that involves a human, real-world interaction, I think will probably persist. And then beyond that, I think it's a big open question. I think this is a big, big economic alignment. And so, for example, what does education mean in this new world? Yes, teaching is still a very human thing, but how do we prepare our students for this new world? Or how do we think about, you're talking about the Nobel Prize winning researcher. I think it's entirely possible that in 7 to 10 years for some of these domains that the AI is actually smarter than the Nobel Prize winning, physicist or whatever. And so when you get the superhuman intelligence on the other side of that, what are the consequences? And I don't think anybody really has a great answer to that yet, other than the human systems will persist. Anything that involves information, anything that involves data, anything that involves computer code, the AI is probably going to be better than humans at in relatively short order.
So that sounds pretty scary to a lot of folks, obviously. I mean, especially because we're an economy that is optimized for, lack of a better sort of term, for IQ. We're an economy that is optimized toward intelligence. And now you're saying that basically intelligence is no longer the metric for success because it's going to be available to everybody. In the same way that the manufacturing resources have now become unbelievably available to everybody. You don't have to have a manufacturing facility to get anything you want at your front door in a day.
Yeah.
It's going to be like that, except with intelligence. And so what, the sort of where the mind goes is to places like, okay, so now you're going to be optimizing for emotional quotient, right? You're going to be optimizing for how well people deal with people. If you're an extrovert, you're going to do really well in this new economy. If you're an introvert, you might be a little bit screwed, right? The engineer types are going to have a real tough time. But if you're somebody, if you're a face for the AI to teach kids, then that'll be okay. It also raises serious questions, presumably, about the educational process itself. What do you even teach kids and I see this even with my own kids now, right? I mean, like my son, who's a smart kid, I'll bet he was delayed by about a year because he understood how voice to text worked. He would just grab my phone and instead of actually typing in the question the way that he might if you were able to read, he would just, actually just voice the question and then you'd have the phone read it back to him. He never actually had to do that. So what exactly are we going to be teaching kids and how does that affect the brain? Because obviously, I mean, these are all open questions. When it comes to, it seems to me that you stop teaching kids math, for example, because it's so easy to just do everything using AI. Doesn't that atrophy a part of the brain that you might actually have to use? I mean, there are kind of general uses that are taught via specific skill sets and that apply more broadly.
Yeah, all excellent questions. I don't think anybody has the answer. I think there are two ways to sort of think about it, two data points you might consider. So one is a lot of this was sort of what happened on the internet. So imagine you're in 1990. And you can see the internet coming. You can see e-commerce coming. You can see video conferencing coming. You can see social media coming. What would you do? That is the question I'd be asking myself if I were a parent right now, if I were a teacher, if I were a white collar worker. If you understood that the internet was happening in 1990, what would you have done? And I think probably what you do is you start getting really, really familiar with the technology. You start writing emails. You start buying stuff online. You start, you know, buying PCs and sort of staying on top of it, so that by the time you're in, you know, the year 2002, you've sort of upskilled yourself. You've gotten to a place where you understand what these tools are capable of, and you've reskilled, and so you're able to sort of move into this new world. You know, could anybody have predicted that, you know, in 2010 or 2020, you would have, you know, the entire media landscape would look fundamentally different than it did in 1995? I think that was a big leap. But if you understood the tools, you were well positioned to sort of move into that new world as it happened. So I think that's one mental model you might have, is what happened in the 90s and what would you have done? If you knew everything that you knew about the internet today, but you're in 1990, what would you do? And I think that's probably the best you could do, is let's just get really, really familiar with the technology. Let's make sure we buy our kids a PC. Let's make sure that they play with it every day. And by the time they're 10 or 12 or 15, they'll have an intuitive sense for how this technology works, and then they'll be okay. The second thing I would observe is that all of these transitions are very scary in the moment. Right. Whether it's the internet, whether it was PCs, whether it was, you know, factories, whether it was railroads, whether it was the car, all the way back to the printing press. Right. And there's always this fundamental debate that happens. There's always this fundamental question that happens between two groups of people. One group of people says, you know what, the current system is fine. And actually, we don't need this technology. We don't want this technology because it's going to be so disruptive that a bunch of people will be left behind. And there's another group of people who say, no. As scary as this thing is, it's a tool that will make life better. And I think every time you look at the tools that humanity creates, if we choose to adopt them, life gets better, right? So take something like the printing press. It was a big driver in why we have literacy. And I think you would be hard-pressed to argue that people being able to read is a bad thing. But there were actually people around that time that said, actually, learning to read is a bad thing. We don't want people to learn how to read. This creates a negative social consequence. You know, what if people can actually read the Bible and understand what it says? Like, that's really dangerous. We don't want that. But I don't think anybody would make that argument today. And so I think AI, we're probably going to look at similarly in 20 years. I think we're going to say, you know what? Like, yes, it was a transition. But on balance, it was extremely positive. And it does create some societal questions about how we manage that transition for people, so we don't end up with a rust belt, the way that we sort of, I think, abandoned a bunch of people in the 80s and 90s and didn't reskill them. And this is a problem that we need to think about. But I think on balance, it's going to be extremely positive. And the best you can really do is just immerse yourself in it. And so, you know, for example, at work, in our company, what we've done is, we literally, every person is required to use an AI. And every day you have to use it. And we share productivity tips. And so we have a Slack channel where people are sharing these tips. We have an engineering team internally, and we task them with going and actually getting these open source models and running the code and actually trying to build agents that will be able to do the job of a finance person or an operations person, so that we can scale our business 10x without hiring more people. And so I think the people that just sort of jump in the deep end today will be at a tremendous advantage in 2 to 5 years.
So a couple of the challenges that people brought up as possible theoretical challenges is, one is called the data wall.
Yep.
The basic idea being that what happens when, right now, LLMs, large language models, are learning based on the amount of data that's on the internet. What happens when people stop producing the data because the LLMs are actually producing all the data, and then they're really not producing the data, they're synthesizing the data that's already there. So do we hit a point where, because there's no new human created data that's actually being input, that basically the internet runs out of data? And there are some people who sort of suggest that that's not going to happen. There are some people who suggest that it will. What do you make of that question?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. I tend to think we will probably not run out of data anytime soon. I think there are large domains that are private data that are not yet fully tapped. And so I think when you think about things like medical records, bank records, financial data, government data, there's a lot of data actually that's not yet been ingested into these systems. I also think that the AI creating stuff, it does create sort of a self-referential feedback loop, but I think a lot of that data is quite valuable. And so you will have a lot of quote-unquote AI-generated data or potentially even synthetic data. And I think if you can put a layer on top of that to have some sort of filtering that says, actually, this data is good data, you might actually get really interesting feedback loops that actually the AI can sort of learn from the AI. So I think it's a big open question. I'm sort of on the side of, actually, I think we'll get better and better at using the existing data that we have, and there are still large pockets of data that are untapped. And so I don't think we've hit sort of the top of the S curve in terms of being able to hit, you know, diminishing returns with data yet.
When it comes to another question I've seen raised about this is the question of innovation. How much can AI actually innovate as opposed to sort of performing sophisticated recombination, which I suppose actually goes to what exactly is innovation? Is it just sophisticated recombination, or is it something else? It's sort of like you're in the shower and the flux capacitor hits you when you fall off the toilet, or like what exactly is that? How far can AI go in terms of what we would perceive to be innovation? Also, because whenever there's a sophisticated technology, human beings tend to then map their own model of the brain onto the sophisticated technology. So for a while it was the brain is a computer,
yeah,
and now it's the brain is an AI.
Yeah.
And how accurate is that?
Yeah, I think it's a tricky question. I think there's going to be a class of innovation that this stuff is really good at, which is when you have large amounts of data and you can interpolate inside those data sets, you can infer a lot. You can learn new things. And so you see, for example, things like protein folding. We have a lot of data and we can start to learn how these things might work and how these systems might work. I think there's some people who think that actually extrapolating beyond the data, creating entirely new frameworks and new ways of thinking is something that, that humans are uniquely good at. I tend to be on the side of, you know what, every time humans say that somehow we're special and unique, it turns out to be incorrect. And so whether we're talking about, voice, whether we're talking about, we're talking about the Turing test. And for a long time, Alan Turing was one of the pioneers of computer science. He created this test that basically said, if you can talk to a computer, and maybe that's textual, maybe that's voice, but let's say it's text, and you cannot distinguish, let's say you have a black box and you sort of are asking it questions and it gives you answers. If you cannot tell if on the other side of it is a human or a computer, that is intelligence that's indistinguishable from a human. And we've passed the Turing test at this point, right? You can talk to an LLM and it looks like a human. For all you know, it's a human type in that response and it appears to be, self-aware and cognizant. It's not, but it appears to be that way. And so we actually passed this really important milestone that most people don't talk about, which is the Turing test. And so I look at that and I say, well, there are a whole set of things that humans have claimed for a long time are uniquely human that these things based on silicon are now doing. Why, if we have an existence proof for a set of things that we thought were uniquely human that now these computers can do, why would it be the case that there are a whole set of other things that these computers would not be able to do? So I'm kind of on the side of it's just a matter of time that these things are able to replicate all of these things, including the ability to extrapolate and the ability to create new frameworks and to be creative. I think, it may take longer, but I think those things will ultimately fall too.
We'll get to more on that in just a second. Folks, the fight to strengthen our nation and protect life continues, especially as abortion remains a central issue. Preborn's impact speaks volumes, having helped save over 300,000 babies through their compassionate approach. By providing ultrasounds to moms with unplanned pregnancies, they create a powerful moment of connection. When a mom sees her baby and hears their heartbeat, the chances of choosing life double. Preborn's network of clinics stands ready to support both moms and babies. Meet Deanna. Her baby literally called out from the womb, and she knew that life was the only choice. Your tax-deductible donation of $28 sponsors one ultrasound. Now through a match, your gift is doubled, saving twice as many babies. Please donate. Just dial #250, say keyword baby. That's #250, baby. Or go to preborn.com/Ben. That's preborn.com/Ben. They're doing amazing work. Every dollar helps. Go check them out right now, preborn.com/Ben. Or dial #250 and say keyword baby. More with my friend Avi Shalgar coming up. This is the Ben Shapiro Show.
Turtle Bay's 5th annual Redding Garden of Lights is back for another fun-filled holiday season. Open on select dates from November 22nd through January 5th. Featuring over 10 acres of outdoor illuminated gardens filled with 2 million lights. Don't miss this year's new additions, including new light displays and premium ticket packages. Plus, holiday-themed food, drinks, music, glowing swings, model trains, and much more. Redding Garden of Lights is presented by Mercy Medical Center Redding. Buy tickets now at turtlebay.org.
The property insurance crisis in California is starting to affect the business insurance property also. 200 to 300% rate increases in business property rates or not writing business insurance at all are becoming the norm. At Siskiyou Insurance, we have over 100 years' experience in writing business insurance in the North State. We can help. We live here and care about our community and want to make sure that you keep your business with a local agent that knows our town and supports it every day. And we'll get you the best deal we can. Call Curtis Byron at Siskiyou Insurance Services, 530-224-2345 or 1-800-773-2345. Siskiyou Insurance, 530-224-2345 or 1-800-773-2345.
Every day, your life is filled with choices. And when a health crisis happens, you need to be prepared to choose the best healthcare partner. That's when Shasta Regional Medical Center is there to answer the call above the rest. Ranked best in Reading and in the nation for patient safety and clinical excellence, you can be confident that when you choose Shasta, you are choosing superior care, safety, and excellence for you and your family. Choose Shasta at ShastaRegional.com.
Attention veterans, did you know that Shasta College and Simpson University have veterans resource centers to assist you in your educational pursuits? These centers offer a wide range of support services, including financial aid, tutoring, IT support, and more. We understand the unique challenges that veterans face and are committed to helping you succeed. Our experienced staff is here to help you navigate the college experience and achieve your academic and career goals. Don't let anything stand in your way. This message is brought to you by Senator Maurice Johannesson, former Secretary of California Veterans Affairs.
John Cruz here with America Outdoors Radio. Be sure to tune in this weekend and catch the latest in fishing, hunting, conservation, and destinations. If you love spending time in the field or on the water or in the woods, you're going to love this show. It's America Outdoors Radio, the fastest growing outdoors radio show in the nation. Tune in Saturdays from noon to 1 p.m. on 96.5 FM and 1460 AM KCNR, your talk radio.
25.
Welcome back. This is the Ben Shapiro Show. So I recently had the opportunity to sit down with my friend Avishal Garg, an expert on AI, crypto, Bitcoin. Fascinating conversation. Here's what it sounded like.
So when we look at the world of AI, and tons of money is pouring into AI, you see sovereign wealth funds all over the planet, people building their own AIs. Well, what exactly does that mean? We say we're building an AI. What does that mean?
Yeah, it's a good question. There's a lot of pieces to it. The thing that most people ultimately see is some sort of a model that they're interacting with that you can, you know, type in text to or maybe speak to. The voice transcription models are getting really good. And the text to voice and voice to text, all that stuff is, all those pipelines are getting really good. That's generally what people think of. There's a whole bunch of infrastructure behind the scenes that makes that possible. Everything from how do you acquire the data, to how do you clean the data, to how do you get some sort of evaluation on it, to how do you actually train these things on very, very large clusters with lots and lots of GPUs, and doing that at a scale that requires, you know, many, many tens of thousands of GPUs and coordinating all of that. It's a lot of infrastructure and computer science that goes into that. And so that's where all the money is going, right? Ultimately, it's how do you take large, large amounts of data, the entire internet, and compress it into these very, very small models that hopefully can run on your phone one day. And the entire process of doing that is extremely capital intensive because the sheer amount of computational resource and data centers and power that you need, the GPUs that you need, are so immense to actually produce these models that you then interact with as an AI. And just requires tens of billions of dollars to be able to actually have all that computational power to create these models.
And how do you tell the difference between the models? Right? I mean, if you're using, are they all using the same data set, or is it just they're using different data sets? Is it weighting? Like, what is the difference?
It's an excellent question. I think at the end of the day, they will basically all be using the same data sets. And so a lot of it comes into how do you do the training. And there's a lot of sort of know-how and sort of proprietary knowledge around how you actually train these things. A relatively small number of people in the world know how to do that today. And out of that come these weights. And those weights effectively let you, understand what, you know, given a word, given a context and a word, what is the sort of the next word that the system would predict. And so those weights, in the case of, let's say, a llama or open source, in the case of something like OpenAI or Anthropic or not open source, but ultimately that's what you're trying to produce. You're trying to produce, sort of take all the data, compress it, and the compression ultimately is producing this sort of set of weights, and the weights are just all they're really doing is saying, given a word, what is the next most likely word? And, you know, I'm glossing over a lot of details, obviously. And that's what we call sort of the AI model. And there's a lot of sort of how do you do the compression? That's sort of all the proprietary stuff. You know, which speaks to actually this sort of really, it kind of goes back actually to this technology problem we've talked about, which is that stuff is very opaque. Actually, even though you can see even though you may be able to see the weights on the final model, you actually have no idea the data that it was trained on. That is not disclosed. And so very subtle biases could be entering into the data that we have no idea about, which presents a real challenge because these are, private corporations. They're not subject to, you know, our vote ultimately at the end of the day. And so we don't really know what's going in to these data sets. We don't really know what's being kept out of the data sets. That's all opaque. And there's no real accountability at this point in terms of what that means. And so there's a lot of sort of, I think open philosophical questions here about like who should get to dictate what goes into the data sets and why, and what does that mean downstream for what these models are. And so there's a real push from some in this community to make all of this open source, not just the weights, but actually open source the entire process. Like, tell me what data you're using. Tell me what data you left out. Tell me why you're using this data. Tell me what your eval scores are. Like, and open source the entire thing. And we'll see if that happens. It's, you know, there's sort of some tricky economic questions there because there's so much money to be made that you kind of don't want to disclose those trade secrets, because you don't want somebody else to be able to replicate this. And so right now, all of that whole pipeline is effectively closed.
Nobody yeah, I mean, the closeness of it does create the possibility of some pretty dystopian
yeah.
issues. I mean, just to take a quick sort of practical example, I mean, when you used to use Google, you would Google a term, and then you'd get a series of web pages, and then you sort of, yeah. it prioritized them in a certain way, but you could always scroll to page two and sort of figure out what exactly you were looking for. Now, you use Google's AI, and it spits out, you know, an answer that it's destroying internet traffic.
Yeah.
Nobody has used a click-through link on Google for several months at this point, and by the time my kids are using it a lot, they won't be using it at all. I mean, it'll just be they type in a prompt, and then the answer comes back out, and then how you determine what that answer actually looks like, how they got to that answer, is going to be very difficult. And so you can certainly see the possibility of bias in the informational environment. And obviously, you know, conservatives are worried about this all the time. Remember when we were first seeing ChatGPT, conservatives were typing in things and it was coming out very left-wing.
Yeah.
And we were saying, well, what are the parameters that are being used on all of this?
Yeah. And there's no visibility into that. It actually, and you know, the argument on the other side is, well, this stuff is really dangerous. We don't want to open source this stuff. What happens if it gets exploited by a rogue government? Or what if bad actors take this technology and do things with it? And so there's this really strong sort of safety movement around some of this. And I don't think it's misguided necessarily, but I think the form that it can take is essentially trust us. Like we are the arbiters of truth. We will do the right thing. But I don't think that's actually the right way to go about doing these things. And you know, we were just to bring it back to the earlier conversation we were having, I think there's actually a very interesting historical analog here around religion, which is, you know, the sort of handful of people that really understand how these systems work and ultimately are making decisions about what data goes into these systems. It's sort of like the church, you know, in sort of, you know, this sort of 1400 era where there's a set of people and they get to dictate what is truth. And over time, you know, even with the best of intentions, even with the best of people, if these things are long lived enough, there is generational transfer. There are new people that come in. And if there's no accountability, the systems have a tendency to become corrupt. And this is what Martin Luther noted, you know, when he banged those 95 theses into the wall at the church, was, wait a second, like the system has become corrupted in all sorts of ways, things like indulgences. And there's no accountability. And what people on one side of it said was effectively, hey, look, knowing how to read and read the Bible and understand this stuff is really dangerous. You need an interpreter. You need an intermediary to help you understand how to do this. And trust us, we're going to filter it in the right way, and we'll do what's right for you, and we'll do what's right for society. And there's another argument that said, no, you should have a direct relationship with God. You should be able to read the Bible and decide what you do. And actually that sort of the 95 theses and the printing press happening at the same time was sort of this confluence of philosophy and sort of technology coming together. And I think there's a very similar philosophical, technological argument and tension happening right now. Do a small group of people get to interpret the data and get to decide what goes into these models, and they get to dictate truth, and you have very little say over that, and whatever they say is true is true? Or do you get to have a direct relationship with the AI? Do you get to have a direct relationship with what data goes into it and how you train it and so on? And there's a lot of people that sort of fall into this world, but it's a scary world, because what you have to do if you take that position is you have to believe that humans are fundamentally good, that if you give them this technology and you give them this knowledge, they'll do the right things with it. On balance, humans are good. But that's a big leap for a lot of people. That's a scary thing to hand over that powerful technology to everybody in the world.
So when you look at the risks of AI, you see sort of the catastrophist risks, the idea that it's going to take over the nuclear missiles and just start firing them at people. You know, how seriously ought we to take the sort of World War III end of humanity risk, the Skynet scenario?
Yeah, I think it's probably overblown, personally. I think it's unlikely that this thing runs away from us in a way that we can't control. I mean, literally, you just shut off the data center, right? It's, we have a kill switch. And so that's not to say you shouldn't, you know, think about these things and, you know, battle harden your systems and so on. But I think, there's a lot of sort of, religious fervor around this. And I think the place where it actually comes from is a desire for control. And it's a fear-based motivation. And it's sort of a degrowth mindset. And I think if you have that kind of a mindset, it's very easy to fall into this trap. And then, of course, the question is like, well, then who gets to decide the safety? And the answer is, well, me, right? And so it's actually sort of like it's a perverse incentive, I think. It's like, by and large, the people that are pushing this argument are very self-interested in wanting to push this argument. And hence, I think the argument gets overblown.
This is the Ben Shapiro Show.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.
News this hour from townhall.com. I'm Ron Taylor. Black Friday still reigns as the biggest day of the year for in-store shopping. White House correspondent Greg Clugston has more on the story.
Retailers have been pushing early holiday sales for weeks now, but the day after Thanksgiving remains an incredibly important day for department stores, shopping malls, and merchants. Many shoppers browse and buy online, but brick-and-mortar stores still enjoy a surge in foot traffic this holiday weekend as bargain hunters look for deals. This year, there are five fewer days between Thanksgiving and Christmas. Greg Clugston reporting.
BankRate.com senior analyst Ted Rossman says there are expectations for a slight growth this year.
The National Retail Federation, Deloitte, MasterCard, various sources place the expected holiday sales growth at somewhere around 2 or 3%. So kind of in line with inflation. Growing, but not exceptionally so.
Also at townhall.com, the head of Britain's Foreign Intelligence Services, Vladimir Putin, is conducting a reckless sabotage campaign against Ukraine's allies that risks escalating the conflict. MY6 Chief Richard Moore says for the sake of the Western security, Russia must not win the war in Ukraine.
If Putin is allowed to succeed in reducing Ukraine to a vassal state, he will not stop there. Our security, British, French, European, and transatlantic, will be jeopardized. The cost of supporting Ukraine is well known, but the cost of not doing so would be infinitely higher.
Insurgents have breached Syria's second largest city, Aleppo, and are battling government forces on the city's western edge. It marks the first time the city has been attacked by opposition forces since 2016, since they were ousted from Aleppo's eastern neighborhoods. You'll find more of these stories, news, and analysis online at townhall.com. I'm Ron Taylor.
Hi, Mom.
Ooh. New administration has hinted at one of its boldest moves yet. America's return to the gold standard. Backing the U.S. dollar with gold would create stability in a time of rapid economic change, pushing the price of gold higher than we've seen in decades. Those who act now could be positioned to benefit the most. Premier Gold specializes in helping those with a 401k, IRA, or other types of retirement accounts utilize a little-known loophole to move some of their savings into physical gold. Today, they'd like to send you a free gold standard kit to help you decide if this process is right for you. Call 606-800-8000 to take advantage of current rollover policies. Early action on physical gold could position your portfolio for maximum growth. Call Premier Gold at 606-800-8000. Call 606-800-8000 now. Premier Gold is not a financial advisor. Please consult with your advisor before investing. Call 606-800-8000.
A handful of Massachusetts lawmakers are taking on the tobacco industry.
The legislators are hoping to persuade their colleagues to support a proposal that would make the state the first to adopt a ban meant to eliminate the use of tobacco products over time. Other locations have weighed similar generational tobacco bans. The bans phase out the use of tobacco products based not just on a person's age, but on the birth year. Lawmakers plan to file the proposal next year.
Correspondent Jeremy House. The NCAA's efforts to get lawmakers to address problems in college sports could pay off in the new Republican-controlled Congress. Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz is set to take over as chair of the powerful Commerce Committee and says a college sports bill would be a top priority. The owner of an oil field in Los Angeles County is suing the state of California over a law that would require it to stop production and plug its wells or face costly fines. Sentinel Peak, owner of the Inglewood oil field, says the law is unconstitutional. Libraries across America are helping people to get healthy.
It's more than just books. Libraries today offer fitness routines, cooking classes, even blood pressure monitors that can be checked out just like books. Libraries in Kansas City and Milwaukee are part of the American Heart Association's program providing blood pressure stations or take-home kits. And nearly a dozen libraries in Central Texas receive training for various health efforts, including mental health and isolation. Jason Walker reporting.
Stocks close with solid gains as Wall Street put the finishing touches on one of its biggest months of the year. The S&P 500 rose 0.6%, while the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 188 points, or 0.4%. The NASDAQ added 0.8%. Friday was an abbreviated trading day with stocks closing at 1 o'clock and the bond markets an hour later. More news and analysis at townhall.com. I'm Ron Taylor.
Take a look, take down the light, take down the light.
Join me for the first Thursday of every month at 6 p.m. for my show, North State Now. In this one-hour show, we cover what's happening in the music scene, theater, food, and arts. We get in-depth interviews with local business owners, musicians, actors, and authors. Listen in, tune in, call in, participate. Win tickets to concerts and theater productions. It's a lot of fun, and believe me, it keeps us going. Join me, your host, Linda Bott, or North State Now, the first Thursday, right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM. Also streaming at KCNR1460.com.
Hey, and welcome. This is the Ben Shapiro Show. I recently had the opportunity to sit down with my friend Avishal Garg. He's an expert on crypto, Bitcoin, and AI. It's a fascinating conversation. Give it a listen.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, your specialty is the crypto world and crypto. So for people who have, like, no background in crypto, what is it? How does it work? Why is it important?
Yeah, so it depends how far you want to go down the rabbit hole, but crypto, well, the old school version of crypto is just cryptography. And all that is math that lets you secure data and prove facts about the world. And it's actually really important to the internet in general. It's why we can do things like credit cards on the internet. That's cryptography. Crypto, as it's become to be known over the last decade, is really, how do you use cryptography and distributed systems, really to move money around and do new kinds of computation. And so this really started with Bitcoin circa 2009. And that sort of kicked off what we call the modern crypto. And, that came out of a sort of an observation or sort of a political belief that the legacy financial systems were messed up and broken. And so if people go back to 2008, the economy was falling apart. The banks had sort of done a bunch of things that they shouldn't have been doing. And so there was a computer scientist or a scientist, by the name of Satoshi. It was a sort of a pen name, and they published a white paper, articulating how you might do peer-to-peer cash without the need for a bank in the middle. And so how could I transfer money and transfer value to somebody else without without a bank in the middle? And it actually was a combination of both computer science, like legitimate technology breakthroughs, and some really interesting social design. And kind of the fundamental thing that they did as a trade-off, they said, well, the legacy systems are really designed around efficiency. And what if instead of saying, I'm going to optimize for efficiency, I optimize for security. And so you optimize for things like self-sovereignty. I'm going to own my own data. And I don't want to trust an intermediary. And so rather than trusting these banks, I choose to not trust them. Could I do the same things? Could I actually move my money around? And it turns out you can. And it was kind of a crazy idea. It was published anonymously. The white paper was put out. Some code, open source code was put out. And it started to take off. And, you know, here we are almost 14 years, 15 years later. And that core sort of insight around Bitcoin is now almost a $1 trillion asset. There's been a whole sort of explosion of other crypto assets around that, and cryptocurrencies and crypto projects around that. That whole ecosystem is worth, you know, somewhere around $2 trillion at this point. So, you know, a lot has evolved in the last 15 years, but kind of the core original insight was, what if I wanted to do things and I don't trust these intermediaries anymore? Which I think touches on a lot of sort of things that people have really started to feel over the last 5 or 10 years in particular. But this was sort of the computer scientist version of, if I wanted to do the things I wanted to do before, how would I do them without trusting any intermediaries?
So you can certainly see why established institutions would not like this, because it's quite disruptive. If you're the banking industry and you're used to people using you for those mechanisms of exchange no longer that's being used, you're not going to like that. If you're a government, you might not particularly like it, because you've been in charge of the monetary supply. And now when you're looking at something like Bitcoin, it has its own established value, a value established by the market. I want to get to sort of the institutional opposition to Bitcoin and to crypto generally. But first, what do you think that crypto has become? So there's a lot of talk early on about wide adoption of crypto as a mechanism of exchange, as opposed to a second property of it, which is a repository of value. That basically it's like digital gold. I'm hedging against inflation in the economy. And so I buy a bunch of gold, I put it in my safe, and, you know, a year from now it's worth more money. Some people have used Bitcoin like that. But there are obviously other uses for crypto.
Yeah.
What are the various uses for crypto?
Yeah, so what it's really become is sort of from that original insight of, potentially the ability to move money around, I think people started to say, well, actually, this is just a new computational infrastructure. What it really does is, you know, like if you look at Amazon or Facebook or Google, they really built their entire infrastructure around speed and efficiency and scalability. And so you got massive centralization, which you see on the internet. You got these intermediaries like Facebook or Google or Amazon that sort of concentrated all of the users and concentrated all of the money and all of the power. And it's partly an outgrowth of what the infrastructure lets you do. So the way the internet was designed, you sort of got this necessary centralization effect, because scale sort of makes things more efficient. In this world, if you start from an assumption of, well, what if I don't want centralization? What if I don't want to trust my counterparty? And what if I'm willing to trade off some efficiency to get these sorts of properties? You sort of start from a different premise. And so the infrastructure has grown in a different way. And Bitcoin was just the first application, this idea of a non-sovereign store of value. Almost like a digital gold. And as that sort of started to take off, people started to say, well, you know, what if you could write code around this? What if it's not just about transferring the value, but what if I could, because, you know, as soon as the money becomes ones and zeros, ones and zeros is just, you know, a thing that a computer can recognize. And so what if you wrote code around that? And so starting in about 2015, with Ethereum, people started to say, well, if I can write code around money, I can now program money. And when you start thinking about a lot of the world, a lot of the infrastructure of the world, whether it's wills or trusts or escrow agreements, if you bought a house, or insurance, securities, derivatives, like what are all of these things? Fundamentally, what they are is here's a pile of resources, here's a pile of money, and I have some rules around who can access that money, and I have some rules around what happens over time with that money. There's cash flows that come off of it, or you know, in the event of my passing, something needs to happen with this pile of resources. And now, instead of all of that being written in legal documents, we could write it in code. We could write it in software. And that insight sort of kicked off an entirely new sort of, arm and branch of what's known as crypto today, that started to explore this idea of what would it look like if you could write code that owned money and operated around money. And so now the kinds of use cases that you're starting to see that have really taken off are, for example, stable coins. And this is the idea that actually a lot of the world wants to transact US dollars. And it's quite painful to do that. If anybody's actually... And the example we always use is if you wanted to get money from, let's say, San Francisco to London, and it's Friday afternoon, you are actually better off going to the bank, pulling out $20,000, putting it into a briefcase, buying a flight, getting on a plane, and going to London and then handing somebody the suitcase. Because if you send a wire, it's not going to get there till Tuesday, right? The banks are closed on the weekends. They don't settle wires. It'll take T+1 to settle on Monday. And so maybe the money shows up on Tuesday, and you could actually have the money in a suitcase there, you know, Friday night or Saturday morning. And that's kind of crazy, right? In 2025 almost here, there are very few parts of the world where atoms actually move faster than bits, and money continues to be one of them. And so now you can actually send money via USD stablecoins, and it's 24/7. It shows up instantly. It shows up in somebody's wallet, and then they can off-ramp it back to their bank account when the bank's open. But it's actually the best, fastest, cheapest way to move US dollars in the world now. And so you're seeing on the order of about $1 trillion a quarter of money movement happening with this stuff. And for a lot of sort of international use cases, so you're seeing, for example, a lot of remittance volume start to go through stablecoins in the Gulf or in Southeast Asia, where a lot of people want dollars and they can't get access to dollars. And there are large populations of people in the West from those markets. And it's just a better way to do business. I mean, like we use this for investing in startups because we can just send money, over the weekend after you invest in a company. And so you're starting to see now businesses start to look at this and adopt this as one of the novel and interesting things. And so once you realize that you can actually, you know, money is digital and you can write code around money, it opens up this whole new universe of, well, what are all the things that were technology built in the 1970s, and we can do those things in a drastically different way today. And so you're starting to see new emerging use cases even beyond just the basic sort of US dollar money movement into things like lending, into things like stable swaps, so like Forex sorts of use cases, like really sort of base infrastructure that we haven't really had to think about since maybe World War II, you know, Bretton Woods and in the 1950s, where we invented a lot of this infrastructure. But we're reimagining it now with 2024 computer science, which is just faster, cheaper, better, more scalable.
So, I mean, all of this sounds pretty amazing, and yet there's tremendous regulatory heartburn over all of this. So, to sort of steel man the regulatory worries, what exactly are people most worried about that they are now suggesting there needs to be a heavy regulatory regime around some of the use cases or around the original technology?
Yeah, so the backdrop here, so I think it's important to also contextualize this globally. So it turns out the U.S. is a bit of an outlier in this. Actually, most of the world is very, very happy to have these technologies. And I think it's an interesting history lesson, which is if you go back to the 90s and the U.S. internet, there's Section 230 that sort of happens, and it was, part of the Telco Act of 96. And it was a really, really important piece of legislation because what it did was it opened the door to the internet, the modern internet as we know it. And really what it said was, you know what, these technologies are a little bit different. They're not exactly like newspapers that have editorial staff and you can sort of control these things in the way that you did the newspapers. We've got to think about these rules differently. And so, for example, it set aside rules that said, well, you know, if you're a digital forum, like a Facebook or YouTube, you have different rules than a newspaper might have. And actually, like if you, you know, as a media person, you don't need to go to the FTC to get a media license, a radio license to publish on the internet. And so these sort of basic ground rules understood that the technology was different in some fundamental ways. And so we needed some new rules to account for how it was different. That ushered in the modern internet. Like the reason America won the internet was because some of these rules were put in place in the late 90s. And so we got Amazon, we got Facebook, we got YouTube, and we got Google and all the sort of mega tech companies. Now the rest of the world looked at this and today has a set of challenges. Like if you're Europe, if you're, you know, Brazil, if you're India, if you're China, you're looking at these things and you're saying they're so, so, so important in society as sort of fundamental pieces of infrastructure. We have zero leverage over them. Like, you know, if you want to call in one of the CEOs of these companies and you're Europe, are the CEOs going to come? No, they're American. They're American citizens. They're in America. Like they're subject to U.S. law. They will abide by most of these laws in these other places, but you have relatively little leverage actually over these companies because fundamentally they're American companies. So it's a tremendous national security asset that these ended up being American companies. So now the rest of the world looked at this and said, oh, we kind of lost the internet. We don't want to repeat that mistake. And so if you look at what the rest of the world is doing around things like crypto or AI, they're really leaning into it. And what they're trying to do is figure out how do we make these companies successful in our domestic markets? Because if we can do that, we'll actually, in the long term, have leverage. And we won't be beholden to these American companies over whom we have no leverage. So actually, the rest of the world has gone very pro-crypto. UK, Germany, Singapore, many of these markets are actually embracing it and leaning into the technology. They're giving visas to people. Dubai, they're giving visas to people to come build these companies. The United States, on the other hand, I think we learned some wrong lessons, which is because we were the beneficiaries, it's almost like a resource curse. We sort of won the internet and we forgot in many ways why we won and we sort of take it for granted and how powerful these entities are and how important they are from an economic perspective and a national security perspective. And so we're kind of botching it a little bit. And so there's a lot of sort of dragging your feet. There's a lot of opposition. There's a lot of fear about what these things might do rather than sort of optimism about how amazing things could be. And so the U.S. is a bit of an outlier. And specifically in the U.S., a lot of the concern fundamentally comes down to, in my opinion, a philosophical concern, which is who gets to control these things. And I think from a government perspective, you know, the legacy financial system and a lot of these computational companies like an Amazon or a Google, well, you can call the CEO. You can have them come testify. You can yell at them. You can get your PR moment or you can find them. How do you do that with a decentralized crypto network? How do you really think about that? And the reality is you can't. There's no who you're going to come yell at about Bitcoin. You can't. And even if you could, there's nothing they can do about it, right? The code is open source and it's running and it's autonomous. And this presents a real challenge, I think. And we don't really have a great framework for how to think about that. I think the last time, in my opinion, that we had to think about these kinds of issues was frankly like the invention of the LLC, like in the 1850s. So if you go back and look at the history of limited liability corporations, we invented, it was actually a fantastic technological breakthrough, something like the Dutch East India Company, which said, let's pool a bunch of capital and we'll go pursue this venture. And that charter, you had to go get that charter from the king. So the king would give you a charter to start a corporation and you could pool assets and then go pursue risk opportunities. And it was really a separation of sort of capital risk from the people pursuing that, with their skills. It took about 150 or 200 years, but a lot of people started to say, well, wait a second, why do you need to go to the king to talk about these things? It's like, why can't I just start a company? And so around 1850 in the UK and the US, we created really simple ways for people to create corporations. And it's actually really fascinating. If you go back and look at some of the debates that were happening at the time, there were really interesting questions like, well, you know, are these things people? Like, do they have rights? What happens if there is a fire and somebody dies? Like, who's liable? Is it the owner of the thing or is it the company or who pays? Will these things have free speech rights? Will they be able to, like, participate in elections? What does that mean? Will they have too much power and money? And there were, like, actually a lot of really interesting questions that were surfaced at the time. But what we said was, you know what? This is a useful new technological construct. And so let's create some rules around things like corporations and LLCs. And that was a really big breakthrough because that was a big part of what allowed things like railroads or the Industrial Revolution, because now you could aggregate capital to pursue opportunities at a scale that you just previously could not. And that sort of fundamental set of questions of like, how does this work and what are the rules? People had to really sit down and think about things like liability and ownership, free speech rights and all these things. We haven't really had to face that for 150 years. We are now faced with a similar set of questions here around, well, these are decentralized networks. There isn't a CEO that you can just call. So how does liability work? How does free speech work? Like if I can write code and just put it on the internet, isn't that free speech? What happens if something goes wrong? How do we think about things like KYC and anti-money laundering? And how do we prevent terrorist financing? There's some really fundamental questions here that we need to sort of sort through. I don't think the answer is to just say no, because the reality is that that's not an answer, because this stuff is happening globally now. And so I think the U.S. has actually sort of dragged its feet, and there's been a lot of opposition, but I think it's actually to the detriment of the U.S. to not have, people thinking about these questions and trying to answer them.
More of my friend Avishal Garg coming up. This is the Ben Shapiro Show.
Looking for a unique gift this Christmas? Memory Lane Antiques, Vintage and Collectibles in the Shasta Gateway Center on Highway 273 in Anderson has distinct treasures to choose from, including Christmas decorations, vinyl records, DVDs, vintage toys, and antique jewelry, such as brooches and rings, necklaces and bracelets. Memory Lane Antiques, Vintage and Collectibles also offers vintage clothing and accessories, such as retro dresses and scarves, jackets and hats, along with vintage furniture, tablecloths and silverware, cookware, and glassware. And don't forget Mantiques, including military memorabilia, camping and mining equipment, men's jewelry such as crosses and rings, sports memorabilia, and collectibles. Come find that perfect gift this Christmas at Memory Lane Antiques, Vintage, and Collectibles in the Shasta Gateway Center on Highway 273 in Anderson. Open Monday 10 to 6, close Tuesday and Wednesday. Open Thursday through Saturday from 10 to 6, and Sunday noon to 5.
I'm Shannon Phillips with the McConnell Foundation. Happy holidays. During this time, it's important to salute our military personnel, domestically and abroad, who work to keep our country safe. It's during the holidays, that warm, happy feeling of being together with family, that we sometimes take for granted how much we have to be thankful for. So we want to make sure that we let the families and those who serve know that we appreciate their service above self during the holidays.
Cornerstone Community Bank is proud to partner with KCNR for Operation Holiday Salute. We'd like to express our heartfelt gratitude to veterans and active duty service members for their dedication and sacrifice. Cornerstone Community Bank offers personal and business banking solutions tailored to fit your unique needs. We invite you to experience the warmth of banking with us. Visit one of our four branches in Redding, Anderson, or Red Bluff, or online at bankcornerstone.com. Cornerstone Community Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Smoke and sap, dirt and grime, leaves and pollen, and even bugs. Just a few things that can possibly damage your vehicle's paint over time, causing it to pit, fade, and oxidize, basically ruining your paint job. Quick and Clean Car Wash can help. Quick and Clean Car Wash at the corner of Market and Eureka Way in downtown Reading invites you to stop by and enjoy their all-cloth car wash, where they take the time to pre-wash and hand-scrub your car or truck. Quick and Clean Car Wash also offers car wash packages. Quick and Clean Car Wash at the corner of Market and Eureka Way in downtown Reading.
If the American people ever allow private banks to control the issuance of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and the corporations that will grow up around them will deprive the people of all their property until their children wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Revolution has started.
Sovereign Minds, now on Sundays, 10 to noon.
5.
Welcome back. This is the Ben Shapiro Show. So I recently had the opportunity to sit down with my friend Avishal Garg, an expert on AI, crypto, Bitcoin. Fascinating conversation. Here's what it sounded like.
So when you look at sort of the current regulators and the regulatory environment, give me some examples of some badly thought out legislation or badly thought out regulation. Obviously, if you spend any time in this world at all, even like me, sort of casually, the name Gary Gensler comes up a lot.
Yeah,
there are regulators who are widely, shall we say, disliked in sort of these communities, in the crypto community, for being heavy-handed, for believing that you can sort of put the genie back in the bottle. What does bad regulation look like? What are the problems?
Yeah, well, bad regulation is actually no regulation. It's regulation by enforcement. And so there's no legislation. And so what we really need are clarity of the rules. And it's actually, it's pretty crazy. I've never worked in a space that is demanding legislation the way that the crypto industry is. Like, people go to senators and congresspeople and like, please regulate us. Like, tell us what the rules are, because we want to follow the rules. Because in the absence of these rules, what you really end up doing is empowering the bad actors, right? What you end up doing is the people who are willing to skirt the law, who are not willing to spend time working with the regulators or the legislators to figure this stuff out, are the ones who just go off and start, you know, doing scammy things, and then people ultimately lose their money. And so, for example, if you look at, you know, the really famous example of this from a few years ago is FTX, which is, sort of an American company. It was a bunch of American founders, but they moved to the Bahamas to run their business. And so it looked like an American company, but in practice was not an American company. It was not regulated by the United States. They were not subject to disclosure rights in the U.S. But a lot of people trusted them because they looked like an American company. And it ended up being a $10 billion fraud, and Sam Bankman-Fried is going to jail and so on. But that's a perfect example of the lack of legislation and clarity creates the opportunity for these sorts of bad actors to come in and exploit the system. Meanwhile, the good actors are trying to figure out how to comply, and it's unclear how to do that. And so when it comes to some of these agencies, what you really see happening is that they are taking this ambiguity and in the absence of clarity from the legislators are essentially deciding the rules and dictating those rules. And sometimes those rules are applied arbitrarily and capriciously. These are literally words that judges have used. And a handful of companies that have the resources are now taking the SEC to court and winning. And it's actually pretty remarkable. I mean, for anybody who studied the history of the agency model and Chevron and sort of these recent rulings that have happened, it's pretty fascinating because historically, you know, if the SEC gave you a Wells notice or said, we're taking you to court, their hit rate was so good. They were so trusted. Like, your stock would tank if you got a Wells notice. These days, because they've taken such a different strategy of issuing Wells notices and frankly losing in court multiple times, the market just doesn't even take that seriously anymore, which is a real, I think, hit to the credibility of the agency at the end of the day. And so what's happened is we actually don't have legislation. We don't have regulatory clarity. The agencies are trying to do this through enforcement. And then when it goes to court, they're in many cases losing. And that's just an extremely expensive way to run an industry. And so this is why the industry is going to, there are many great legislators on both sides, on Democrats and Republicans. You know, Senator Gillibrand from New York. You have Richie Torres from New York on the Dem side. You have Ro Khanna here from California. You have Patrick McHenry, who's the chair of the House Financial Services Committee. You have people who are trying to push this forward. But that's what we ultimately need, is we need some sort of legislation to start clarifying what the rules actually are and actually telling the agencies what the rules are, because in the absence of that, the agencies are taking this into their own hands.
So you mentioned economic growth and innovation. Obviously, the area that's seen tremendous amounts of investment right now is in AI. So let's talk about AI. I think a lot of people are very, very nervous about AI, about what it's going to do.
Yeah.
Now, there's sort of the tech optimist view, which is it's an amazing new technology. It's going to allow for innovation at a level that we've never seen before, because essentially at a certain point, you are going to reach artificial general intelligence, which means effectively, why don't you define what artificial general intelligence is?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because AGI sort of has a couple of different flavors of it. I think one version of it is, well, there's another test that we talk about, which is the Turing test. But AGI, generally the way people will describe it is, for an arbitrary task, this software could perform as well as an arbitrary human. So, you know, an average typical human. Now there's a lighter weight version of that that you might say, well, for some universe of tasks, will this outperform? So it's not universal in the sense that, a human is very good at learning how to drive a car and ride a bicycle and also do their taxes and also learn email and learning software. And so maybe you don't get AGI that is necessarily good at doing all of those things, but you might have some sort of human level intelligence that for certain types of tasks, it does as well as human. I think we're more likely to be able to get that level of intelligence relatively quickly. The broader, like, it can learn anything with very limited data. You know, humans are phenomenal with a couple of data points. You know, like, you can teach a 4-year-old how to ride a bike in a couple hours. It's pretty remarkable that we can do that. That I think is some time away. And so if you define AGI that way, that's probably many years away. If you define AGI as for certain types of intellectual tasks, it will do as well as a typical human. I think that's on the order of like 2 years away.
More of my friend Avi Shalgar coming up. This is the Ben Shapiro Show.
Turtle Bay's 5th annual Reading Garden of Lights is back for another fun-filled holiday season, open on select dates from November 22nd through January 5th. Featuring over 10 acres of outdoor illuminated gardens filled with 2 million lights, don't miss this year's new additions, including new light displays and premium ticket packages. Plus, holiday-themed food, drinks, music, glowing swings, model trains, and much more. Reading Garden of Lights is presented by Mercy Medical Center Reading. Buy tickets now at turtlebay.org.
Owners, landlords, and tenants trust Authority Property Management at 2663 Victor Avenue. They manage a variety of properties, including single-family homes, apartments, condos, townhouses, multifamily properties, and commercial properties. Authority Property Management offers full-time management, including finding and screening tenants, rent collection, financial reporting, and final walkthrough home inspections when they move out. Contact Authority Property Management today at 530-410-6085 and check out their website at authoritypm.com.
Cornerstone Community Bank is proud to partner with KCNR for Operation Holiday Salute. We'd like to express our heartfelt gratitude to veterans and active duty service members for their dedication and sacrifice. Cornerstone Community Bank offers personal and business banking solutions tailored to fit your unique needs. We invite you to experience the warmth of banking with us. Visit one of our 4 branches in Reading, Anderson, or Red Bluff, or online at bankcornerstone.com. Cornerstone Community Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Attention veterans, did you know that Shasta College and Simpson University have veterans resource centers to assist you in your educational pursuits? These centers offer a wide range of support services, including financial aid, tutoring, IT support, and more. We understand the unique challenges that veterans face and are committed to helping you succeed. Our experienced staff is here to help you navigate the college experience and achieve your academic and career goals. Don't let anything stand in your way. This message is brought to you by Senator Maurice Johannesson, former Secretary of California Veterans Affairs.
Hi friends, RC here with this month's Cigar of the Humidor. Don Pepin Original Exclusivos Nicaraguan Puro Corojo Wrapper equals a Don Pepin Classic. Cubanesque in flavor, strength, and size, this is the stick to celebrate your latest victory. Get yours today at Tobacco and Brew, Redding, California.
When people ask me for a recommendation for a heating or air conditioning company, I always say Alliance Heating and Air. Why? Well, they've been taking care of our HVAC system for 14 years. Professional, friendly, and willing to go to the extra step for their customers. I have found no problem too difficult or too minor for them to repair. I recommend Alliance Heating and Air with no reservations. You can reach them at 530-221-2642 or online at homecomfort.org. And they have 24/7 emergency assistance. Alliance Heating and Air.
Looking for the freshest top-shelf flower? Look no further than the Queen of Dragons in the city of Shasta Lake, where they work directly with small, local farmers to bring you the finest flower that fits your price. The Queen of Dragons has the best prices on carts, edibles, concentrates, and pre-rolls. Plus, don't miss happy hour every day from 6 p.m. until close and all day Sundays. Don't just stock up on toilet paper. The Queen of Dragons has great deals, so you can stock up on the best flower for the best prices. So what are you waiting for? Stop by Queen of Dragons at 5044 Shasta Dam Boulevard or call 530-238-5638 for details or delivery. That's 530-238-5638. And don't forget to follow Queen of Dragons on Facebook and X at the Queen Dragons for all the latest deals and updates. Support Queen of Dragons, a local business in the city of Shasta Lake, where you will find the most friendly and knowledgeable staff. Queen of Dragons at 5044 Shasta Dam Boulevard. Visit queenofdragons.com or follow us on X at the Queen Dragons.
If you haven't been listening to TV Confidential, this is who you're missing.
Louis Gossett Jr.
Eric Braden.
Samson Williams.
Burt Ward.
Peter Marshall.
Lindsay Wagner.
Loretta Swit.
Michelle Nichols.
Shirley Jones.
Louise Sorrell.
Good actor. A lovely, enchanting interview. Conversation. It wasn't an interview.
Well, thank you. That's what I try to do. I try to make this a conversation.
You made it.
That's TV Confidential.
Saturday morning at 11 on KCNR.
Join Aaron Ryan and Bill Cundiff for We the People Radio every Sunday from noon until 2. Our expert guests will give you the whole story rather than a bunch of sound bites. Our commercial-free archives are always available at wethepeopleradio.us.
Sponsored in part by Pape Machinery, located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard, for all your local John Deere Ag and Turf products. Join us every Sunday from noon until 2, wethepeopleradio.us.
What shall we do about them?
Hey, and welcome. This is the Ben Shapiro Show. I recently had the opportunity to sit down with my friend Avi Shalgarg. He's an expert on crypto, Bitcoin, and AI. It's a fascinating conversation. Give it a listen.
Yeah, so when we get to the second order effects, which is, I think, what people are mostly worried about, the societal effects of what happens when, you know, half the population, at least in the temporary term, hasn't adjusted yet to the shift. Because, as you mentioned, if you look at the history of American economic growth, there have been a number of industries where it used to represent a huge percentage of the workforce and now it represents a tiny percentage of the workforce, and people moved into other jobs. But there is this lag effect. I mean, America used to be a heavily agricultural economy. Yeah. It was a heavy manufacturing-based economy. Now it's a heavy service economy. And so when that, you know, is taken over by AI, when AI is doing a lot of those tasks, what do you think is the sort of next thing that human beings are still going to be better at than machines? Like, presumably there will be a cadre of experts in every field who will still be better than the machines are, because they'll be the geniuses who are, you know, if you're a Nobel Prize winning nuclear physicist and you have a bunch of grad level students who are working for you, but they're all AIs.
Yeah.
It wipes out the grad level students. It doesn't necessarily wipe out the nuclear level, the Nobel Prize winning nuclear physicist. But, you know, if you're not that guy, if you're everybody else, which is, you know, 98% of the population, what exactly do you think is left for those people to do?
Yeah, I think a lot of it will become human-to-human interactions. So there are certain things that humans ultimately will still want human interfaces for. So, for example, going to the doctor. So an AI is going to be better at diagnosing you. AI is already better at diagnosing than most doctors today. But there's something fundamentally human about going to the doctor's office and having somebody talk to you and listen to you. That doesn't go away. And so the modality of how you do your job in a lot of human-to-human interactions will change pretty fundamentally. And we'll have to retrain a bunch of people on how to use these tools properly. But I think what you'll see is anything that involves a human, real world interaction, I think will probably persist. And then beyond that, I think it's a big open question. I think this is a big, big economic alignment. And so, for example, what does education mean in this new world? Yes, teaching is still a very human thing. But how do we prepare our students for this new world? Or how do we think about, you're talking about the Nobel Prize winning, researcher. I think it's entirely possible that in 7 to 10 years for some of these domains that the AI is actually smarter than the Nobel Prize winning, physicist or whatever. And so when you get the superhuman intelligence on the other side of that, what are the consequences? And I don't think anybody really has a great answer to that yet, other than the human systems will persist. Anything that involves information, anything that involves data, anything that involves computer code, the AI is probably going to be better than humans at in relatively short order.
So that sounds pretty scary to a lot of folks, obviously. I mean, especially because we're an economy that is optimized for, lack of a better sort of term, for IQ. We're an economy that is optimized toward intelligence, and now you're saying that basically intelligence is no longer the metric for success because it's going to be available to everybody. In the same way that the manufacturing resources have now become unbelievably available to everybody. You don't have to have a manufacturing facility to get anything you want at your front door in a day.
Yeah.
It's going to be like that, except with intelligence. And so what the sort of where the mind goes is to places like, okay, so now you're going to be optimizing for emotional quotient, right? You're going to be optimizing for how well people deal with people. If you're an extrovert, you're going to do really well in this new economy. If you're an introvert, you might be a little bit screwed, right? The engineer types are going to have a real tough time. But if you're somebody, if you're a face for the AI to teach kids, then that'll be okay. It also raises serious questions, presumably, about the educational process itself. What do you even teach kids and I see this even with my own kids now, right? I mean, like my son, who's a smart kid, I'll bet he was delayed by about a year because he understood how voice to text worked. He would just grab my phone and instead of actually typing in the question the way that he might if you were able to read, he would just, actually just voice the question and then you'd have the phone read it back to him. He never actually had to do that. So what exactly are we going to be teaching kids and how does that affect the brain? Because obviously, I mean, these are all open questions. When it comes to, it seems to me that you stop teaching kids math, for example, because it's so easy to just do everything using AI. And doesn't that atrophy a part of the brain that you might actually have to use? I mean, there are kind of general uses that are taught via specific skill sets and that apply more broadly.
Yeah. All excellent questions. I don't think anybody has the answer. I think there are two ways to sort of think about it, two data points you might consider. So one is a lot of this was sort of what happened on the internet. So imagine you're in 1990. And you can see the internet coming. You can see e-commerce coming. You can see video conferencing coming. You can see social media coming. What would you do? That is the question I'd be asking myself if I were a parent right now, if I were a teacher, if I were a white-collar worker. If you understood that the internet was happening in 1990, what would you have done? And I think probably what you do is you start getting really, really familiar with the technology. You start writing emails. You start buying stuff online. You start, you know, buying PCs and sort of staying on top of it so that by the time you're in, you know, the year 2002, you've sort of upskilled yourself. You've gotten to a place where you understand what these tools are capable of and you've reskilled. And so you're able to sort of move into this new world. You know, could anybody have predicted that, you know, in 2010 or 2020, you would have, you know, the entire media landscape would look fundamentally different than it did in 1995? I think that was a big leap. But if you understood the tools, you were well positioned to sort of move into that new world as it happened. So I think that's one mental model you might have is what happened in the 90s and what would you have done? If you knew everything that you knew about the internet today, but you're in 1990, what would you do? And I think that's probably the best you could do is let's just get really, really familiar with the technology. Let's make sure we buy our kids a PC. Let's make sure that they play with it every day. And by the time they're 10 or 12 or 15, they'll have an intuitive sense for how this technology works and then they'll be okay. The second thing I would observe is that all of these transitions are very scary in the moment. Right. Whether it's the internet, whether it was PCs, whether it was, factories, whether it was railroads, whether it was the car, all the way back to the printing press. Right. And there's always this fundamental debate that happens. There's always this fundamental question that happens between two groups of people. One group of people says, you know what? The current system is fine. And actually we don't need this technology. We don't want this technology because it's going to be so disruptive that a bunch of people will be left behind. And there's another group of people who say, no. As scary as this thing is, it's a tool that will make life better. And I think every time you look at the tools that humanity creates, if we choose to adopt them, life gets better, right? So take something like the printing press. It was a big driver in why we have literacy. And I think you would be hard-pressed to argue that people being able to read is a bad thing. But there were actually people around that time that said, actually, learning to read is a bad thing. We don't want people to learn how to read. This creates a negative social consequence. What if people can actually read the Bible and understand what it says? Like, that's really dangerous. We don't want that. But I don't think anybody would make that argument today. And so I think AI, we're probably going to look at similarly in 20 years. I think we're going to say, you know what? Like, yes, it was a transition. But on balance, it was extremely positive. And it does create some societal questions about how we manage that transition for people. So we don't end up with a rust belt the way that we sort of, I think, abandoned a bunch of people in the 80s and 90s and didn't reskill them. And this is a problem that we need to think about. But I think on balance, it's going to be extremely positive. And the best you can really do is just immerse yourself in it. So, you know, for example, at work, in our company, what we've done is, we literally, every person is required to use an AI. And every day you have to use it. And we share productivity tips. And so we have a Slack channel where people are sharing these tips. We have an engineering team internally and we task them with going in and actually getting these open source models and running the code and actually trying to build agents that will be able to do the job of a finance person or an operations person, so that we can scale our business 10x without hiring more people. And so I think the people that just sort of jump in the deep end today will be at a tremendous advantage in 2 to 5 years.
So a couple of the challenges that people have brought up as possible theoretical challenges is one is called the data wall.
Yep.
The basic idea being that what happens when right now LLMs, large language models, are learning based on the amount of data that's on the internet. What happens when people stop producing the data because the LLMs are actually producing all the data and then they're really not producing the data, they're synthesizing the data that's already there. So do we hit a point where because there's no new human created data that's actually being input, that basically the internet runs out of data. And there are some people who sort of suggest that that's not going to happen. There are some people who suggest that it will. What do you make of that question?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. I tend to think we will probably not run out of data anytime soon. I think there are large domains that are private data that are not yet fully tapped. And so I think when you think about things like medical records, bank records, financial data, government data, there's a lot of data actually that's not yet been ingested into these systems. I also think that the AI creating stuff, it does create sort of a self-referential feedback loop, but I think a lot of that data is quite valuable. And so you will have a lot of quote-unquote AI-generated data or potentially even synthetic data. And I think if you can put a layer on top of that to have some sort of filtering that says, actually, this data is good data, you might actually get really interesting feedback loops that actually the AI can sort of learn from the AI. So I think it's a big open question. I'm sort of on the side of actually I think we'll get better and better using the existing data that we have, and there are still large pockets of data that are untapped. And so I don't think we've hit sort of the top of the S curve in terms of being able to hit, you know, diminishing returns with data yet.
When it comes to another question I've seen raised about this is the question of innovation. How much can AI actually innovate as opposed to sort of performing sophisticated recombination, which I suppose actually goes to what exactly is innovation? Is it just sophisticated recombination or is it something else? It's sort of like you're in the shower and the flux capacitor hits you when you fall off the toilet or like what exactly is that? How far can AI go in terms of what we would perceive to be innovation? Also because whenever there's a sophisticated technology, human beings tend to then map their own model of the brain onto the sophisticated technology. So for a while it was the brain is a computer,
yeah.
And now it's the brain is an AI.
Yeah.
And how accurate is that?
Yeah, I think it's a tricky question. I think there's going to be a class of innovation that this stuff is really good at, which is when you have large amounts of data and you can interpolate inside those data sets, you can infer a lot. You can learn new things. And so you see, for example, things like protein folding. We have a lot of data and we can start to learn how these things might work and how these systems might work. I think there are some people who think that actually extrapolating beyond the data, creating entirely new frameworks and new ways of thinking is something that humans are uniquely good at. I tend to be on the side of, you know what, every time humans say that somehow we're special and unique, it turns out to be incorrect. And so whether we're talking about, voice, whether we're talking about, we're talking about the Turing test. You know, for a long time, Alan Turing was one of the pioneers of computer science. He created this test that basically said, if you can talk to a computer, and maybe that's textual, maybe that's voice, but let's say it's text, and you cannot distinguish, let's say you have a black box and you sort of are asking it questions and it gives you answers. If you cannot tell if on the other side of it is a human or a computer, that is intelligence that's indistinguishable from a human. And we've passed the Turing test at this point, right? You can talk to an LLM and it looks like a human. For all you know, it's a human typing that response and it appears to be, self-aware and cognizant. It's not, but it appears to be that way. And so we actually passed this really important milestone that most people don't talk about, which is the Turing test. And so I look at that and I say, well, there are a whole set of things that humans have claimed for a long time are uniquely human that these things based on silicon are now doing. Why, if we have an existence proof for a set of things that we thought were uniquely human that now these computers can do, why would it be the case that there are a whole set of other things that these computers would not be able to do? So I'm kind of on the side of it's just a matter of time that these things are able to replicate all of these things, including the ability to extrapolate and the ability to create new frameworks and to be creative. I think, it may take longer, but I think those things will ultimately fall too.
We'll get to more on that in just a second. Folks, the fight to strengthen our nation and protect life continues, especially as abortion remains a central issue. Preborn's impact speaks volumes, having helped save over 300,000 babies through their compassionate approach. By providing ultrasounds to moms with unplanned pregnancies, they create a powerful moment of connection. When a mom sees her baby and hears their heartbeat, the chances of choosing life double. Preborn's network of clinics stands ready to support both moms and babies. Meet Deanna. Her baby literally called out from the womb, and she knew that life was the only choice. Your tax-deductible donation of $28 sponsors one ultrasound. Now through a match, your gift is doubled, saving twice as many babies. Please donate. Just dial #250, say keyword baby. That's #250, baby. Or go to preborn.com/Ben. That's preborn.com/Ben. They're doing amazing work. Every dollar helps. Go check them out right now, preborn.com/Ben. Or dial #250 and say keyword baby. More with my friend Avi Shalgar coming up. This is the Ben Shapiro Show.
Alan Gordon, Coachmaster Collision. Although Coachmaster is recognized as the authority and specialist in frame and suspension, we are primarily your auto body and truck collision repair center. This includes all vehicles, Lexus, Honda, or pickup trucks. Our technicians are highly trained and have the most advanced equipment to ensure a complete and quality repair. With our knowledge and the insurance claim process, all we need is your claim number to handle your claim. Coachmaster has a great working relationship with all insurance companies. This ensures a complete repair with quality parts and a delay-free process. At Coachmaster, in our 50 years in business, we've experienced almost every situation imaginable in a claim. This experience and personal dedication to the repair of your vehicle sets Coachmaster apart from all other choices. And yes, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
Happy holidays from our Home Helpers family to yours. At Home Helpers, we are proud to help your loved ones celebrate this holiday season from the safety and comfort of their own homes. We are equally proud of the men and women who can't be with us. To the bravest among us, far from home serving our country this holiday season, to all members of the military in all branches, past and present, and those who made the ultimate sacrifice, with respect, gratitude, and love, we thank you. Happy holidays from all of us at Home Helpers. Life takes you to unexpected places. Love brings you home.
At Greg's Pump and Well Service, we believe integrity is the cornerstone of everything we do. This month, we proudly salute our armed forces and first responders, those who embody true service, dedication, and integrity. When you choose us for your pump and well needs, you're choosing a company that shares those same values. Thank you for your service. Let us serve you with pride. 530-282-5395. Call us at 530-282-5395. License 109-0355.
I'm Steve Coburn, proud owner of Country Air Pet Resort here in Reading. I invite you to come and take a tour of my revitalized pet resort. Our goal here at Country Air is to make sure your pet can relax and have a healthy, happy time away from home. With friendly, caring people, lots of fresh air and exercise, good healthy food, and plenty of pampering. There are no small cages here. What we offer are large temperature-controlled runs and spacious exercise yards that are great for fun and socialization. We even offer daycare. Cats are treated to a two-room apartment plus playtime in our playroom. So stop by and take a tour of the best. You and your pet will want to come back to Country Air Pet Resort, where our motto is, we treat your pets as if they were our own. Country Air Pet Resort, 549-3335.
Welcome back. This is the Ben Shapiro Show. So I recently had the opportunity to sit down with my friend Abhishek Garg, an expert on AI, crypto, Bitcoin. Fascinating conversation. Here's what it sounded like.
So when we look at the world of AI, tons of money is pouring into AI. You see sovereign wealth funds all over the planet, people building their own AIs. Well, what exactly does that mean? We say we're building an AI. What does that mean?
Yeah, it's a lot of pieces to it. The thing that most people ultimately see is some sort of a model that they're interacting with that you can, you know, type in text to or maybe speak to. The voice transcription models are getting really good. And the text to voice and voice to text, all that stuff is, all those pipelines are getting really good. That's generally what people think of. There's a whole bunch of infrastructure behind the scenes that makes that possible. Everything from how do you acquire the data to how do you clean the data to how do you get some sort of evaluation on it to how do you actually train these things on very, very large clusters with lots and lots of GPUs and doing that at a scale that requires, you know, many, many tens of thousands of GPUs and coordinating all of that. It's a lot of infrastructure and computer science that goes into that. And so that's where all the money is going, right? Ultimately, it's how do you take large, large amounts of data, the entire internet, and compress it into these very, very small models that hopefully can run on your phone one day. And the entire process of doing that is extremely capital intensive because the sheer amount of computational resource and data centers and power that you need, the GPUs that you need, are so immense to actually produce these models that you then interact with as an AI. And just requires tens of billions of dollars to be able to actually have all that computational power to create these models.
And how do you tell the difference between the models? Right? I mean, if you're using, are they all using the same data set or is it just they're using different data sets? Is it weighting? Like what is the difference?
It's an excellent question. I think at the end of the day, they will basically all be using the same data sets. And so a lot of it comes into how do you do the training? And there's a lot of sort of know-how and sort of proprietary knowledge around how you actually train these things. A relatively small number of people in the world know how to do that today. And out of that come these weights. And those weights effectively let you, understand what, you know, given a word, given a context in a word, what is the sort of the next word that the system would predict. And so those weights, in the case of, let's say, a llama or open source, in the case of something like OpenAI or Anthropic or not open source, but ultimately that's what you're trying to produce. You're trying to produce, sort of take all the data, compress it, and the compression ultimately is producing this sort of set of weights, and the weights are just all they're really doing is saying, given a word, what is the next most likely word? And, you know, I'm glossing over a lot of details, obviously. And that's what we call sort of the AI model. And there's a lot of sort of how do you do the compression? That's sort of all the proprietary stuff. You know, which speaks to actually this sort of really, it kind of goes back actually to this technology problem we've talked about, which is that stuff is very opaque. Actually, even though you can see you may be able to see the weights on the final model, you actually have no idea the data that it was trained on. That is not disclosed. And so very subtle biases could be entering into the data that we have no idea about, which presents a real challenge because these are private corporations. They're not subject to, you know, our vote ultimately at the end of the day. And so we don't really know what's going in these data sets. We don't really know what's being kept out of the data sets. That's all opaque. And there's no real accountability at this point in terms of what that means. And so there's a lot of sort of, I think open philosophical questions here about like who should get to dictate what goes into the data sets and why, and what does that mean downstream for what these models are. And so there's a real push from some in this community to make all of this open source, not just the weights, but actually open source the entire process. Like tell me what data you're using. Tell me what data you left out. Tell me why you're using this data. Tell me what your eval scores are. Like, and open source the entire thing. And we'll see if that happens. It's, you know, there's sort of some tricky economic questions there because there's so much money to be made that you kind of don't want to disclose those trade secrets because you don't want somebody else to be able to replicate this. And so right now, all of that whole pipeline is effectively and closed. Nobody.
Yeah, I mean, the closeness of it does create the possibility of some pretty dystopian issues. I mean, just to take a quick sort of practical example, I mean, when you used to use Google, you would Google a term, and then you'd get a series of web pages, and then you sort of it prioritized them in a certain way, but you could always scroll to page two and sort of figure out what exactly you were looking for. Now you use Google's AI, and it spits out, you know, an answer that it's destroying internet traffic. Yeah. Nobody has used a click-through link on Google for several months at this point, and by the time my kids are using it a lot, they won't be using it at all. I mean, it'll just be they type in a prompt, and then the answer comes back out, and then how you determine what that answer actually looks like, how they got to that answer, is going to be very difficult. And so you can certainly see the possibility of bias in the informational environment. And obviously, you know, conservatives are worried about this all the time. Remember when we were first seeing ChatGPT, conservatives were typing in things and it was coming out very left-wing.
Yeah.
And we were saying, well, what are the parameters that are being used on all of this?
Yeah, and there's no visibility into that. And actually, and you know, the argument on the other side is, well, this stuff is really dangerous. We don't want to open source this stuff. What happens if it gets exploited by a rogue government? Or what if bad actors take this technology and do things with it? And so there's this really strong sort of safety movement around some of this. And I don't think it's misguided necessarily, but I think the form that it can take is essentially trust us. Like, we are the arbiters of truth. We will do the right thing. But I don't think that's actually the right way to go about doing these things. And you know, we were, just to bring it back to the earlier conversation we were having, I think there's actually a very interesting historical analog here around around religion, which is, you know, the sort of handful of people that really understand how these systems work and ultimately are making decisions about what data goes into these systems. It's sort of like the church, you know, in sort of you know, this sort of 1400 era, where there's a set of people and they get to dictate what is truth. And over time, you know, even with the best of intentions, even with the best of people, if these things are long lived enough, there is generational transfer. There are new people that come in. And if there's no accountability, the systems have a tendency to become corrupt. And this is what Martin Luther noted, you know, when he banged those 95 theses into the wall at the church, was, wait a second, like, the system has become corrupted in all sorts of ways, things like indulgences. And there's no accountability. And what people on one side of it said was effectively, hey, look, knowing how to read and read the Bible and understand this stuff is really dangerous. You need an interpreter. You need an intermediary to help you understand how to do this. And trust us, we're going to filter it in the right way, and we'll do what's right for you, and we'll do what's right for society. And there's another argument that said, no, you should have a direct relationship with God. You should be able to read the Bible and decide what you do. And actually, that sort of the 95 theses and the printing press happening at the same time was sort of this confluence of philosophy and sort of technology coming together. And I think there's a very similar philosophical, technological argument and tension happening right now. Do a small group of people get to interpret the data and get to decide what goes into these models, and they get to dictate truth, and you have very little say over that, and whatever they say is true is true? Or do you get to have a direct relationship with the AI? Do you get to have a direct relationship with what data goes into it and how you train it and so on? And there's a lot of people that sort of fall into this world, but it's a scary world, because what you have to do if you take that position is you have to believe that humans are fundamentally good, that if you give them this technology and you give them this knowledge, they'll do the right things with it. On balance, humans are good. But that's a big leap for a lot of people. It's a scary thing to hand over that powerful technology to everybody in the world.
So when you look at the risks of AI, you see sort of the catastrophist risks, the idea that it's going to take over the nuclear missiles and just start firing them at people. You know, how seriously ought we to take the sort of World War III end of humanity risk, the Skynet scenario?
Yeah, I think it's probably overblown, personally. I think it's unlikely that this thing runs away from us in a way that we can't control. I mean, literally, you just shut off the data center, right? It's we have a kill switch. And so that's not to say you shouldn't, you know, think about these things and, you know, battle harden your systems and so on. But I think, there's a lot of sort of, religious fervor around this. And I think the place where it actually comes from is a desire for control. And it's a fear-based motivation. And it's sort of a degrowth mindset. And I think if you have that kind of a mindset, it's very easy to fall into this trap. And then, of course, the question is like, well, then who gets to decide the safety? And the answer is, well, me, right? And so it's actually sort of like it's a perverse incentive, I think. It's like, by and large, the people that are pushing this argument are very self-interested in wanting to push this argument. And hence, I think the argument gets overblown.
This is The Ben Shapiro Show.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.
News this hour from townhall.com. I'm Ron Taylor. Five Democratic lawmakers from Connecticut say Thanksgiving bomb threats were made against their homes.
Senator Chris Murphy and Representatives Jim Himes, Joe Courtney, John Larson, and Johanna Hayes all reported being the subject of such threats. Police who responded said they found no evidence of explosives on the lawmakers' properties. The bomb threats against Democrats happened a day after a number of President-elect Donald Trump's most prominent cabinet picks and appointees reported that they had received such threats, as well as swatting attacks in which perpetrators initiate an emergency law enforcement response against a victim under false pretenses. I'm Norman Hall.
U.S. Customs and Border Protection agents have seized more than 3,000 fake Gibson electric guitars shipped from Asia during a raid at the Los Angeles Beach Support Seaport. Officials say had the guitars been authentic, they would have been worth $18 million. The agency says Gibson confirmed the guitars were counterfeit. Also at townhall.com, as winter approaches, Ukraine's military faces a desertion crisis in its ranks.
Soldiers, lawyers, and Ukrainian officials tell the AP that tens of thousands of tired and bereft Ukrainian troops have walked away from combat and frontline positions. According to military commanders and soldiers, entire units have abandoned their posts, leaving defensive lines vulnerable and accelerating territorial losses. Some take medical leave and never return. Others clash with commanders and refuse to carry out orders, sometimes during firefights. The war has largely been going Russia's way, and the desertions could put Kiev at a clear disadvantage in future ceasefire talks. I'm Karen Shamas.
Authorities are investigating after a Russian national who did not have a ticket boarded a Paris-bound Delta flight in New York and was arrested when the plane touched down. Delta Flight 264 took off Tuesday evening from Kennedy and landed at Charles de Gaulle Airport in Paris the next day. More at townhall.com.
If you are 65 or older, you know this. Inflation is hitting everyone hard right now, especially when it comes to health care. Over the last 10 years, health care costs have skyrocketed by, get this, 230%. If you have Medicare Parts A and B, you know there are still out-of-pocket expenses like deductibles and copayments, and they really add up. But here's some good news. MediShare 65 Plus is designed to fill in those gaps and help protect you from rising healthcare costs. At only $99 per month up to age 75, you get peace of mind at a price you can afford. And MediShare is trusted, too. It's been around 30 years. It's not some big impersonal thing. It's a community of people helping each other, business owners, pastors, retirees. People love it. MediShare 65 Plus just makes sense. To learn more, give them a call. They're great to talk to. They'll offer to pray with you each time you call, too. Call now, 855-PSALM-32. That's 855-PSALM-32, 855-PSALM-32.
Canada's antitrust watchdog is suing Google over alleged anti-competitive conduct to the tech giant's online advertising business.
The agency wants the company to sell off two of its services and pay a penalty. Canada's Competition Bureau says that such action is necessary because an investigation it conducted into Google found that the company unlawfully tied together its ad tech tools to maintain its market dominance. The matter is headed for the Competition Tribunal, a quasi-judicial body that hears cases brought forward by the Competition Commissioner about noncompliance with the Competition Act.
Correspondent Jeremy House reporting. Nothing set just yet. However, there could be some big changes coming to college sports. The NCAA's efforts to get lawmakers to address problems in college sports could pay off in the new Republican-controlled Congress. Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz is set to take over as chair of the powerful Commerce Committee. Breaking news at townhall.com. British lawmakers have given initial approval to a bill that would help terminally ill adults commit suicide. The so-called assisted dying bill was approved Friday by a vote of 330-275 after an impassioned parliamentary debate. Supporters say the law will provide dignity to the dying. Speaking on behalf of the bill's opponents, Conservative lawmaker Danny Kruger says the bill could be used for the wrong reasons.
Let today not be a vote for despair, but the start of a proper debate about dying well, in which we have a better idea than a state suicide service, in which we remember that we have intrinsic value, that real choice and autonomy means having access to the best care possible and the fullest control over what happens to you while you live, that true dignity consists in being cared for to the end.
Black Friday gave way to a white weekend in parts of New York State, the first big snow of the season, has the potential to bury towns along Lakes Erie and Ontario during a hectic holiday travel and shopping weekend. You'll find more on these stories at townhall.com. I'm Ron Taylor.
Happy holidays from our home helpers family to yours. At Home Helpers, we are proud to help your loved ones celebrate this holiday season from the safety and comfort of their own homes. We are equally proud of the men and women who can't be with us. To the bravest among us, far from home serving our country this holiday season, to all members of the military in all branches, past and present, and those who made the ultimate sacrifice, with respect, gratitude, and love, we thank you. Happy holidays from all of us at Home Helpers. Life takes you to unexpected places. Love brings you home.
This is Carl Bott. Join Linda and me Monday through Friday from 7 to 9 a.m. for Free Fire Radio right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM, your talk radio. We're going to discuss what's happening in our city, county, state, and nation. Join in. Miss a day, miss a lot. Free Fire Radio, Monday through Friday, 7 to 9 a.m.
Thanks for tuning into the Matt Walsh Show. You know, over the weekend, I finished the book Skeletons on the Zahara. It tells the story of James Riley, captain of the merchant ship Commerce, which shipwrecked off the coast of North Africa in 1815. Riley, along with his entire crew, found themselves stranded in the vast Saharan desert, where they began to die from thirst and exposure almost immediately. That was only the beginning of their troubles, of course. The men were soon seized and enslaved by a band of desert nomads. And from that point, the crew was split off in different directions as each man was sold and traded from one nomad to the next. They were abused, starved, beaten, found themselves on a hierarchy where white slaves, Christian dogs as they were called in Arabic, occupied a rung on the social ladder somewhere well beneath camels and probably donkeys. And at one point, Captain James Riley was traded for an old blanket, just to give you an idea of how much they were valued. Several of the slaves were lost into the interior of the continent and never were heard from or seen again. Doomed to live out their lives in bondage, though their lives would have been mercifully short. You can only live so long when you're being used as a pack animal in the desert and forced to subsist on snails and camel urine, which is what they were consuming most of the time. But Riley and a few of his men managed to escape with the assistance of a comparatively merciful Arab who ransomed them for several hundred dollars and a couple of muskets. Yet the survivors never escaped the physical or mental trauma of their experiences, and most of them died relatively young, but two of them, including Riley, did publish books about their experiences, and both books were sensations at the time that they were published. Captain James Riley would become a household name. Even Abraham Lincoln named his book Sufferings in Africa as one of his greatest inspirations. The funny thing, though, is that this incredible and true tale, which was once widely known and renowned across the country, has faded into obscurity in recent years. In fact, the author of Skeletons on the Zahara, Dean King, only found out about the story and decided to write a book about it after stumbling across an old, dusty, leather-bound copy of Riley's memoir while researching another book at the New York Yacht Club Library in 1995. It's the only reason he even knew about this. So why don't more people know about this story? Why isn't it taught in schools? Why haven't there been movies made based on it? It is an incredible story. The book was actually adapted as a screenplay before it was even published, with DreamWorks attached, back in like 2001. But the film was never made, and then 5 years, or rather 10 years later, in 2010, another screenplay was written. But that project also fizzled out. Movie was never made. There's no mystery here, of course. This story has fallen into the cracks of history because it touches the tip of an iceberg that our educational establishment, the media, and Hollywood would all prefer that we not acknowledge or explore. And that would be the subject of white slaves in Africa. Riley and his men were not the only ones, not by a long shot. In fact, over the course of a few centuries, well over a million white people were enslaved in northern Africa. A million. Some of them detained and enslaved after being shipwrecked, but the vast majority were abducted right off of ships still at sea or from coastal European communities by Muslim raiders who carried them back to Africa to be sold, traded, or ransomed. In some cases, entire communities, coastal European communities, were ransacked. Hundreds of people captured at one time. You know, the United States fought a whole war, a series of them, the Barbary Wars, to put a stop to this practice. There's a reason, though, that school curricula tends to skip over that conflict, going from, you know, the Revolutionary War to the War of 1812 to the Civil War, hop, skipping, and jumping over some of these more uncomfortable and troublesome episodes. There's a concerted effort in our society to erase, ignore, and cover up not just the story of white slaves in Africa, but almost the entire global history of slavery in general. The impression that we're supposed to have is that the transatlantic slave trade, white Westerners enslaving Africans, which was actually only a small piece of the transatlantic slave trade, but that's the only form of slavery that ever existed. That's the impression we're supposed to have. Black Africans were the victims, white Americans and Europeans were the villains. End of story. And this is indeed what many people believe, because that is what our culture wants them to believe. This point was driven home when I posted a thread about the true history of slavery to Twitter on Saturday. Thinking about all these issues, you know, after having just finished the book, I posted this. This is what I said. Well over 1 million whites were enslaved in northern Africa between the 16th and 19th centuries, most of them abducted and sold by Muslim pirates. Africans were raiding Europe for slaves for hundreds of years. The school system has totally erased this fact from history. Continuing. Of course, white people were enslaved in other parts of Africa, too, and across the world for centuries, including in North America, where white servants, quote-unquote, were shipped to the colonies by the thousands. Slavery in America didn't begin in 1619. White children were being kidnapped and sold into servitude in the colonies before that. And, of course, slavery existed in the Americas for hundreds of years prior to Europeans ever setting foot there. Indian tribes all practiced slavery. Slavery persisted in non-Western countries long after it had been abolished in the West. Slavery was an accepted institution in Africa and Asia for millennia, and it seems to have never occurred to any of these societies that there might have been something wrong with the practice. And, of course, the African slave trade was mostly furnished by Africans capturing other Africans and selling them into bondage. The African slave trade was abolished by the West, not by Africa. Slavery remained legal in parts of Africa well into the 20th century. Actually, I should have said that slavery was abolished against the, not just, you know, without the help of the non-Western world, but against the objections of the non-Western world, was the slave trade abolished. Everything I wrote there is as true as it is unknown to the average American. But predictably, the outrage mob has been screaming at me for the past 2 days because of this, calling me a Nazi, accusing me of excusing or justifying or minimizing the enslavement of black people, accusing me of upholding white supremacy, quote unquote. My messages and emails have been, as you can imagine, even more colorful than that. But the attacks have come from the right as well. This is not all from the left. Maj Touré is a prominent gun rights activist. Maybe you've seen him on Fox News, maybe you've seen him on YouTube. He launched into a tirade that included many tweets and several videos about me. Beginning with this response, he said, "Dumb, reductive, and horrible attempt at justifying the transatlantic slave trade take here. Conservatives love going full retard and damaging any inroads into black communities with these kind of takes. I just big up dude for the What is a Woman film and then this." Yes, how dare I say something he disagrees with after he just said he likes my movie. I should have known that his endorsement of my film puts me in debt to him for life. I didn't realize that. Others on the right agreed with him, including Aja Smith, who's a GOP congressional candidate, who tweeted, "Maj was correct for calling him out. Far too long, folks are silent when they see and hear a wrong. That's why we're in this disinformation that we're in." Now, despite my urging, I could not get Smith to explain what part of my statement was disinformation. Most of the people angry at me for talking about this issue could not even begin to explain, didn't try to explain, how or why I'm wrong. There was at least one exception. Well-known Twitch streamer, to the extent that any Twitch streamer can be called well-known, Hassan Piker, tried to debunk at least one of the things that I said about slavery. Let's listen to that attempt.
Matt Walsh. Well, over 1 million whites were enslaved in North Africa between the 16th and 19th centuries, most of them abducted and sold by Muslim pirates. Africans were raiding Europe for slaves for hundreds of years. The school system has totally erased this fact from history. First of all, you know, the glories of Muslim pirates doing that was erased probably because the Western world was embarrassed by the L that they held, most likely to the Ottoman Empire, most frequently to the Ottoman Empire, the sick man of Europe. Okay? Of course, white people were enslaved in other parts of Africa, too, and across the world for centuries, including in North America, where white servants were shipped to the colonies by the thousands. Matt Walsh is doing the classic, like, chattel slavery is the same as indentured servitude, which, of course, it's not. Indentured servitude in and of itself is, of course, still completely unacceptable, obviously. The main differences in that situation is that you can actually purchase your way. You can purchase your freedom. Not that it's, like, super likely or whatever, but you can do that, whether there was no purchasing of your freedom as a black slave, okay? Your child was immediately also seen as property, whereas indentured servitude doesn't work that way as well. And that's precisely why there is a difference between the way that, like, Irishmen or the way that Italians or the way that, like, whoever the we're talking about in this situation were able to assimilate or welcome be welcomed into white society in comparison to black people, which Matt Walsh, of course, still doesn't want to welcome into white society. So there you go.
Now, we're going to be generous and ignore the part where he refers to the glories, his words, of Muslims enslaving white people. He considers that a glory. And instead, we're going to focus on his claims about indentured servitude. This is totally different from chattel slavery, he says. And I've heard a lot of this. You hear a lot of this, this attempt to distinguish chattel slavery from other kinds of slavery. Well, in the West, there was chattel slavery, which is so much worse than all the other kinds of slavery. Well, chattel just means property, right? So chattel slavery is when the slave is property. Well, that's slavery. That's the definition of slavery, is when someone is made property. So there is no coherent distinction to be made between slavery and chattel slavery. This is just what people do when they, in fact, are looking to minimize or justify one type of slavery and separate it from other types. In the indentured servitude thing, he says, well, this is very different. But that's also incorrect. In a book called White Cargo, The Forgotten History of Britain's White Slaves in America, authors Don Jordan and Michael Walsh explain, no relation, by the way, as far as I know, that in most cases, an indentured servant, so-called, was simply a slave by another name. The servants were bought, sold, and traded like any other slave, like any other property. And though their period of bondage was supposed to be temporary, oftentimes they were kept in servitude for life after their sentence was complete, because there was no one around to enforce the terms of the deal. Many others were worked to death long before they could be freed. Many of these quote-unquote indentured servants, when they were shipped to the Americas, died within a year because they were worked to death. They were worked harder than you worked your livestock. Also, as the authors explained, many of the servants did not choose that arrangement at all. Kids were kidnapped off the street and sold into servitude. Others were coaxed there on false pretenses and then enslaved. So, yes, there were white slaves in America. There were a lot of them. As a New York Times review of White Cargo says in its concluding sentence, this again is the New York Times, which wrote this, but this was 15 years ago. There are probably tens of millions of Americans who are descended from white slaves without even knowing it. Don't often hear that brought up in the reparations conversation, do you? Now, the fact that white people were slaves should not come as a surprise anyway, given that the word slaves comes from Slav, because Slavic people historically were so often enslaved. Was the enslavement of black people in America completely different in its barbarity from all other forms of slavery across the world and throughout history? No. We've already discussed the conditions of white slaves in Africa and of white children abducted and shipped to America and then literally worked to death. What we see very quickly from any honest study of the history of slavery is that it was unspeakably brutal in all of its forms. Galley slaves on Arab ships were kept in chains for years at a time, not allowed to leave the ship. And then if a British patrol approached and they thought that the slaves were going to be liberated, they would just cut their throats and throw them overboard. Slaves in the Americas before the arrival of Europeans, that is, slaves owned by Native American tribes, because they all owned slaves, were frequently tortured and brutalized, especially in Mesoamerica, where they often would be gutted, dismembered, and sometimes cannibalized during religious rituals. It was not good to be a slave anywhere, let's just say. Maybe we could leave it at that. America was not unique in its relationship with slavery. It wasn't even unique in its exploitation of the transatlantic slave trade. Most slaves from Africa were shipped not to the U.S., but to the Middle East and South America. What makes the USA different from most countries is not that it had slaves. In that fact, it's on the same footing as literally every other country that had existed on Earth until that point, but that it had slaves for such a comparatively short amount of time. But does this matter? I mean, should we be talking about any of this? Well, yes. It matters. It matters because it's true. And it's a truth that a lot of people aren't aware of. And it matters because we cannot study history and, most importantly, learn from it if we're determined to only look at little pieces of the bigger stories. That's why it matters most of all. Slavery was not America's sin or the Western world's sin. It was the entire world's sin. One that the Western world ultimately did far more to stamp out and rectify than anyone else. This is the entire world. I mean, for thousands of years, it's not just that slavery existed for thousands of years. It's that for thousands of years across the world, it hardly even occurred to anyone, even some of the greatest philosophical and religious thinkers for thousands of years across the world, hardly even occurred to anyone that there might be something wrong with the practice in and of itself. There are people who spoke out against the conditions of slaves, against the abuse of slaves, but it's very, very rarely did you hear anyone even get close to criticizing slavery as an institution. This was a massive moral blind spot that virtually everyone who existed on Earth for thousands of years shared. That's an important story. That there could be a blind spot like that, that everyone shares. Something we should probably talk about and think about and learn from. Because as I said, it's the truth. And the thing about the truth is that the more you tell me not to say it, the louder I'll be about it. That's the way it works. We'll be back with the Matt Walsh Show in just a minute. Don't go anywhere.
Turtle Bay's 5th annual Redding Garden of Lights is back for another fun-filled holiday season, open on select dates from November 22nd through January 5th. Featuring over 10 acres of outdoor illuminated gardens filled with 2 million lights, don't miss this year's new additions, including new light displays and premium ticket packages. Plus, holiday-themed food, drinks, music, glowing swings, model trains, and much more. Redding Garden of Lights is presented by Mercy Medical Center Redding. Buy tickets now at turtlebay.org.
Looking for a unique gift this Christmas? Memory Lane Antiques, Vintage and Collectibles in the Shasta Gateway Center on Highway 273 in Anderson has distinct treasures to choose from, including Christmas decorations, vinyl records, DVDs, vintage toys, and antique jewelry, such as brooches and rings, necklaces and bracelets. Memory Lane Antiques, Vintage and Collectibles also offers vintage clothing and accessories, such as retro dresses and scarves, jackets and hats, along with vintage furniture, tablecloths and silverware, cookware, and glassware. And don't forget Mantiques, including military memorabilia, camping and mining equipment, men's jewelry such as crosses and rings, sports memorabilia, and collectibles. Come find that perfect gift this Christmas at Memory Lane Antiques, Vintage, and Collectibles in the Shasta Gateway Center on Highway 273 in Anderson. Open Monday 10 to 6, closed Tuesday and Wednesday. Open Thursday through Saturday from 10 to 6, and Sunday noon to 5.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
Attention veterans, did you know that Shasta College and Simpson University have veterans resource centers to assist you in your educational pursuits? These centers offer a wide range of support services, including financial aid, tutoring, IT support, and more. We understand the unique challenges that veterans face and are committed to helping you succeed. Our experienced staff is here to help you navigate the college experience and achieve your academic and career goals. Don't let anything stand in your way. This message is brought to you by Senator Maurice Johannesson, former Secretary of California Veterans Affairs.
Welcome back to the Matt Walsh Show. This is from page 6. It says, popular YouTube group The Try Guys fired its member Ned Fulmer as he admitted to cheating on his wife, Ariel Fulmer. The group's Instagram page said, Ned Fulmer is no longer working with The Try Guys. As a result of a thorough internal review, we do not see a path forward. We thank you for your support as we navigate this change.
Less than an hour later, Ned, 35, addressed the news on his personal Instagram account. He said, family should have always been my priority, but I lost focus and had a consensual workplace relationship. I'm sorry for any pain my actions have caused to the guys and the fans, but most of all to Ariel. So there's the news on the Try Guys, and this comes on the heels of news about Dude Perfect, the YouTube page Dude Perfect, and they're going to be building, it's positive news, they're apparently building an actual stadium. So the YouTube channel Dude Perfect is building a stadium for themselves, apparently, and I read that headline a couple of days ago. And these two stories together raise the question, who the hell are any of these people? I've never heard of either of them until this week. And they're trending all over social media. Everyone's talking about them. I still don't understand exactly who they are or why anyone cares or what they do. But this kind of goes to show that, yes, I'm out of touch, horribly so, I admit that. Also, though, it shows that there has been this, right, there's, like every week, it's another YouTuber or TikTok person who's all over the headlines and is trending, people are talking about them. And then I, along with the other old fogies among us, I look at that and say, who are they and what even do they do? I don't know, at least when you hear about maybe a pop star or something you've never heard of, it's like you haven't heard of this person, but you understand the concept of pop music, and so you know at least that's what they do and how they became famous. A lot of these people now, I'm not sure what they do. Part of that is this total fracturing and splintering of the culture. And we do take for granted, you know, we take for granted that kids will have different celebrities, different pop culture figures that they're into. And that is relatively normal from a modern perspective anyway. You can go back to Elvis, you know, and back then, the kids were into Elvis and the adults thought that he was a harbinger of evil. And it kind of turns out that the adults were actually correct about that because when you take into account what pop music became over time, I think that they were basically right. But anyway, at least back then, the adults knew who Elvis was, even if they thought he was terrible. And when I was a kid in the 90s, the kids had their pop stars, like we had our pop stars, and the adults didn't really follow it that closely, but they at least knew who the people were for the most part. The adults in the 90s maybe were a little bit less clued in just because there were more pop culture figures to keep track of. But now you go another 20 or 30 years in the future and kids sort of exist in their own universe. They have their own landscape entirely, their own little bubble universe with their own celebrities and nobody even knows who these people are or what they do. There's very little shared culture from generation to generation. There's actually none at all, which is a problem. One other thought related to this. This is another scandal of a famous person, apparently famous person, who is caught cheating, being unfaithful. And this is something men are now getting in trouble for. Adam Levine, who is someone, at least I do know who that is, he's another one who got in trouble for that, for cheating. And that's fine with me, because I think that if you cheat, you commit adultery, you should be shamed publicly for that. Especially if you're a famous person. You've kind of agreed to live your life on the public stage, whether you like it or not. Adultery is a terrible thing, and if people react to it accordingly, then that's good. That's how we should react. But we can only shame them publicly if we're admitting that there is more to sexual morality than mere consent. Right? Because as this guy, what's his name again? Ned, whatever. He says it was a consensual workplace relationship, which is kind of a weird and creepy way to put it when you're describing an affair, but that's what he said. And it's true. It was a consensual relationship. Now, usually what we hear from the left and from the culture is, as long as it's consensual, it's fine. Most was consensual for the two people involved, and it's not fine. And I agree that it's not fine because there's more to consent. Like, consent is baseline. Of course, you need to have consent in a sexual relationship. Otherwise, it's not a relationship at all. It's rape. But that's not the end of it. Things like fidelity and loyalty and love and dignity, all of these things are important as well. And if you remove all of those but you still have consent, it is a disordered and bad thing. So I guess what I'm saying is I have kind of the moral framework, and maybe you have the moral framework, to condemn guys who cheat on their wives, but a lot of these leftists especially who are making a big deal out of this, they don't have the framework for it. Unless they're going to admit that they were wrong about sexual morality this whole time. In which case, I'm happy to have them on board. We'll take a quick break to hear from our sponsors. Don't go anywhere.
Owners, landlords, and tenants trust Authority Property Management at 2663 Victor Avenue. They manage a variety of properties, including single-family homes, apartments, condos, townhouses, multifamily properties, and commercial properties. Authority Property Management offers full-time management, including finding and screening tenants, rent collection, financial reporting, and final walkthrough home inspections when they move out. Contact Authority Property Management today at 530-410-6085 and check out their website at authoritypm.com.
Looking for work? O2 Employment Services has been working with local job seekers for the past 20 years. If you're tired of uploading your resume and getting no response, it's time to let O2 help you find that perfect position. Oh, and by the way, you pay absolutely nothing for our service. If you'd like our help, head on over to our website at o2es.com, click apply now, and complete our online application. We have connections with over 600 local businesses. Once we have your information and understand what you're looking for, we can introduce you to all the positions you may wish to consider. We currently have over 100 available positions, and we would love to match you with the one you're looking for. O2 Employment Services, the North State's leading staffing agency. Give us a call at 530-223-4674. That's 530-223-4674. Or visit us online at o2es.com.
At Greg's Pump and Well Service, we believe integrity is the cornerstone of everything we do. This month, we proudly salute our armed forces and first responders, those who embody true service, dedication, and integrity. When you choose us for your pump and well needs, you're choosing a company that shares those same values. Thank you for your service. Let us serve you with pride. 530-282-5395. Call us at 530-282-5395. License 109-0355.
Cornerstone Community Bank is proud to partner with KCNR for Operation Holiday Salute. We'd like to express our heartfelt gratitude to veterans and active duty service members for their dedication and sacrifice. Cornerstone Community Bank offers personal and business banking solutions tailored to fit your unique needs. We invite you to experience the warmth of banking with us. Visit one of our four branches in Reading, Anderson, or Red Bluff, or online at bankcornerstone.com. Cornerstone Community Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
If the American people ever allow private banks to control the issuance of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and the corporations that will grow up around them will deprive the people of all their property until their children wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Revolution has started.
Sovereign Minds, now on Sundays, 10 to noon.
KCNR, 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and heard online at kcnr1460.com, has teamed up with the Flag Center and are giving you a chance to win an American flag. And there are two ways to qualify to win a beautiful, high-quality American flag by Annan. We will be giving them away every Friday morning at 8:15. Now, the first way to qualify is listen weekdays between 7 a.m. and 9 a.m. with Carl and Linda Bott during Free Fire Radio. And they're going to let you know when to call in to qualify at 530-605-4566. And the second way to qualify, check out our Facebook page. Look for the American flag and type your name in the comments. Then, every Friday morning at 8:15, we will draw a winner of a beautiful American flag from the Flag Center at 2124 Hilltop Drive, and your friends here at KCNR 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and online at kcnr1460.com.
And we're back with the Matt Walsh Show. From the Washington Post, here's a headline that's not really a headline. It says, a Catholic diocese in Michigan has instructed its pastors to deny baptism, confirmation, and other sacraments to transgender and non-binary people unless they have, quote, repented. Possibly the first diocese in the United States to issue such a sweeping policy about those who identify with a gender other than their assigned sex at birth. And let's put a lot of air quotes around sex assigned at birth, because we know that that phrase, it makes no sense at all. Your sex is not assigned at birth. They're not, this is not something that the doctor decides on. It is observed and noted. Sex noted at birth. Sex observed at birth, not sex assigned at birth. No one is assigning anything. As I've said before, they're pulling out a filing cabinet and, saying, okay, well, this one's a boy. Let's grab a penis out of the penis filing cabinet and put it on there. That's not the way it works. Now, sex assigned at birth, it sounds like that's how it works. So I didn't know anything and I was coming in like a blank slate. I had no idea how humanity comes to be and what the birthing process is like or anything. And I was some sort of alien, let's say, landing here. One of Demi Lovato's friends landing here. And I heard about sex being assigned at birth. That's what I would imagine. I would imagine that, oh, well, this is a species where they are born sexless with no kind of genitals or anything. And then all of that stuff is sort of affixed onto them through some kind of process. Maybe it's a lottery process. Who knows? That's not how it works. Anyway, where were we? The guidance issued by the Diocese of Marquette also stipulates that transgender people may not receive communion, in which Catholics believe the body and blood of Jesus Christ are truly present. In most circumstances, they cannot receive the anointing of the sick, which is meant to provide physical or spiritual healing to those who are seriously ill. The guidance was issued in July, but only recently sparked a debate after a prominent priest and advocate for LGBTQ Catholics shared it on Twitter. The document says, the experience of incongruence in one's sexual identity is not sinful if it does not arise from the person's free will, nor would it stand in the way of Christian initiation. However, deliberate, freely chosen, and manifest behaviors to redefine one's sex do constitute such an obstacle. This is yet another example where the media, I always love these stories about the Catholic Church and the media, because they have no idea. Any story that deals with religion, these are godless heathens, and they haven't been inside a church since they were probably 3 years old. If they went inside one now, they'd burst into flames. So they have no idea what they're talking about, and they act surprised and shocked, and they make headlines out of these policies of the Catholic Church or teachings of the Catholic Church that have been in place since forever. Right? And that this is the case everywhere. All dioceses, I have news for you, media, anyone on the left, it's even worse than you think, because all dioceses have, or should have anyway, this exact policy. Because it is a sin to reject your sex, to mutilate your body, to deny your biological selfhood. These are sins. Of course they are. Just think about, now, this idea that you could be born in the wrong body and that this is a problem that has to be corrected through surgery, hormones, whatever. This makes no sense on a purely scientific, biological level. So if we're engaging with this from a secular perspective, that makes no sense at all. Born in the wrong body? What are you talking about? In that case, you are your body. That's all you are. So what is in the wrong body exactly? What do you mean? My brain is in the wrong body. Your brain is part of your body. You might as well say that this is not the right left arm. I should have a different left arm. It makes no sense from a scientific perspective. No sense. But from a religious perspective, which is how the Catholic Church is going to approach this, or again, should be approaching it, it makes even less sense. And it's not just that it makes sense, it's blasphemy. Because now you're saying that if someone made a mistake here, what, it was God? God accidentally, what, infused the female soul into a male body? It was a mistake on the celestial assembly line. Now what you are saying is that God made a mistake, a rather severe, serious mistake of putting the wrong soul into the wrong body. And so what you're saying is I have to correct God's mistake. God gave me this self, but this is the wrong self. I reject it and I'm going to try to make a new one. Of course that's sinful. That's pride. That's blasphemy. That's sacrilege. That's all of the deadly sins wrapped into one package. And this is not my opinion of the Christian approach to this subject. There is no alternative, because the only alternative would be to either remove God from the equation entirely, in which case this thing still makes no sense, or it's to make God, it's certainly something much less than omnipotent and omniscient, all-powerful and all-knowing. Now you have a God who's a sort of a bumbling idiot. He has no idea what he's doing when he's fashioning people. I made you in your womb. I knew you before you were born. And apparently this is a process rife with mistake. I'll have more to say on this in just a minute after a word from our sponsor.
Hello, everyone. For all of you who suffer from calcium oxalate stones, here is some free advice. Tip 1, drink plenty of water. It takes a lot of water to dilute and pass the substances that lead to stones. Tip 2, modify your diet. You'll need to limit sodium, cut your meat.
Tired of difficult lifestyle changes that often don't work? If you suffer from calcium oxalate stones, now there's help. KidneyCop, Calcium Oxalate Protector. Add KidneyCop to your routine as a way to potentially reduce or even stop the formation of calcium oxalate stones. KidneyCop is a dietary supplement developed by doctors and pharmacists. It's been proven in laboratory tests to reduce the rate of calcium oxalate crystal growth by 99%. That's right, 99%. Just take KidneyCop. Satisfaction guaranteed or your money back. You can purchase affordable KidneyCop today by visiting Amazon.com, Walmart.com, or KidneyCop.com. Yes, you can start enjoying life again. Purchase KidneyCop at Amazon.com, Walmart.com, or KidneyCop.com today.
These statements have not been reviewed by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Sponsored by Calcium Oxalate Labs, Inc.
All right. One other thing I want to mention, which is this. Have had this one on the deck here for a few days. This is from the New York Post. It says, an opinion from New York City's eviction court has come down on the side of polyamorous unions. In the case of West 49th Street LLC versus O'Neill, New York City Civil Court Judge Karen May Bakdayan reportedly concluded that polyamorous relationships are entitled to the same sort of legal protection given to two-person relationships. West 49th Street LLC versus O'Neill involved three individuals, Scott Anderson and Marcus O'Neill, who lived together in a New York City apartment, and Anderson's husband, Robert Romano, who resided elsewhere. Anderson held the lease, and following his death, the building's owner argued that O'Neill had no right to renew the lease because he has a non-traditional family member. The attorney for the property owner said that O'Neill's affidavit, in which he claims himself as a non-traditional family member, is a fairy tale. According to LGBTQ Nation, the case returns to court after further investigation of the three individuals' relationship. In her decision, the judge highlighted the importance of a previous case and asserted that the existence of a triad, no matter how they got along, should not automatically dismiss O'Neill's claim to non-eviction protections. Well, whatever the particulars of this case, it's no surprise. We should be surprised by this. And we're going to see a lot more of this kind of thing because, of course, polyamorous, quote-unquote, unions will get legal recognition. Of course they will. What's the argument against them at this point? Polygamy, polyamory, whatever you want to call it, can make a more compelling argument for itself and for marital legitimacy than same-sex unions can. I mean, there's historical precedent for polygamy, and most importantly, a polygamous union, if it's between a man and multiple women, or even the other way around, which you never hear about, but if it was, this is still a union that can be procreative. And as marriage exists by definition to serve as the foundation for the human family, polygamists can make their argument, can kind of stake their claim. Now, it's not an argument that I agree with by any means. I would say that polygamy is disordered, it's unhealthy, it's morally defective, it's an unstable structure for kids. A child needs a mom and a dad, not four moms and a dad, and or the other way around. But the point is that if we as a society have opened up marriage to unions that cannot participate in its purpose and function at all, then on what basis do we exclude polygamy? Well, we don't, of course. There's the one argument against it, which is a very good argument, is out the window. This is always what is meant when we talk about the slippery slope. Okay, that's why we said yesterday, the conservatives who've been predicting slippery slope, saying we're on the slippery slope here and there, and we're always right. We've been right 100% of the time. And why is that? It's because we're not actually predicting it. Like, prediction is not the right way of phrasing it. This is not a prophecy or a prediction. All we're doing is we are, you know, there's a certain thing, action, whatever, that is being that we've decided we're going to accept as a society. And then what we are, those of us who are pointing to the slippery slope, we are listening to the arguments that are being made in favor of this thing, whatever it is. And we're pointing out that, well, you know, you could take that argument fully intact and apply it to all these things over here that right now we all agree are unacceptable. And so if that's the case, then either there's something wrong with the thing you're arguing for right now, or there's something wrong with the arguments you're presenting for it. But if those are the only arguments, and I can take that argument, again, fully intact, and I can bring it over here to these things that all of us agree are bad, that should tell you something. That's all the slippery slope does. And that's why we're always right when we point to it. We'll be right back with more after a quick break to hear from our sponsors.
Hello, everyone. For all of you who suffer from calcium oxalate stones, here is some free advice. Tip 1, drink plenty of water. It takes a lot of water to dilute and pass the substances that lead to stones. Tip 2, modify your diet. You'll need to limit sodium, cut your meat.
Tired of difficult lifestyle changes that often don't work? If you suffer from calcium oxalate stones, now there's help. KidneyCop, Calcium Oxalate Protector. Add KidneyCop to your routine as a way to potentially reduce or even stop the formation of calcium oxalate stones. KidneyCop is a dietary supplement developed by doctors and pharmacists. It's been proven in laboratory tests to reduce the rate of calcium oxalate crystal growth by 99%. That's right, 99%. Just take KidneyCop. Satisfaction guaranteed and your money back. You can purchase affordable KidneyCop today by visiting Amazon.com, Walmart.com, or KidneyCop.com. Yes, you can start enjoying life again. Purchase KidneyCop at Amazon.com, Walmart.com, or KidneyCop.com. today.
These statements have not been reviewed by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Sponsored by Calcium Oxalate Labs, Inc.
We'll take a quick break to hear from our sponsors. Don't go anywhere.
Hi, this is Judy Maxwell. Life can happen in an instant. Sometimes you plan for it, like retirement or taking care of your family. Sometimes it's a surprise, like a winter storm with home or property damage. Sometimes it may be an unexpected accident or illness or even a premature death. Whatever life throws at you, you'll wish you had gotten the right insurance when you had the chance. That's where Maxwell Insurance can help. For more than a quarter century, we've been serving the North State because it's our home too. Give us a call at 221-0441 to let us help you review your policies and prepare you for whatever your future holds. Maxwell Insurance, 1378 Hilltop Drive, 221-0441.
Alan Gordon, Coachmaster Collision. She had minor damage to her rear bumper. I wrote her an estimate. Later, I received a call. The lady responsible for the damage wanted to pay for the repairs out of pocket. Her insurance agent told her a claim would raise her rates for years. With our experience in the claim process, I explained to her most insurance companies would forgive a claim if the cost was below a minimum amount. I suggested she contact her insurance agent and have them review her policy. She called back very excited. It appeared her policy did extend forgiveness. They would pay for the repairs, and she wouldn't be charged with a claim or have to pay a deductible. The accident would not cost her a thing. She was very pleased. Good thing the vehicle owner came to the right place for repairs. We all pay a lot for insurance. Choosing Coachmaster will ensure you get the most for your money. Let this experience work for you. And yes, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
KCNR 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and heard online at KCNR1460.com has teamed up with the Flag Center and are giving you a chance to win an American flag. And there are two ways to qualify to win a beautiful, high-quality American flag by Annan. We will be giving them away every Friday morning at 8:15. Now, the first way to qualify is listen weekdays between 7 a.m. and 9 a.m. with Carl and Linda Bott during Free Fire Radio. And they're going to let you know when to call in to qualify at 530-605-4566. And the second way to qualify, check out our Facebook page. Look for the American flag and type your name in the comments. Then, every Friday morning at 8:15, we will draw a winner of a beautiful American flag from the Flag Center at 2124 Hilltop Drive, and your friends here at KCNR 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and online at kcnr1460.com.
Welcome back to the Matt Walsh Show. You know, we're quite used to hearing insane things from the body positivity camp, but yesterday a body positivity activist and fat acceptance activist named Monica Crete upped the ante considerably. On her social media accounts, which have all now been set to private, Crete calls herself a writer, consultant, educator fighting weight stigma in public health and medicine. She also hosts seminars on the topic of being fat. Unfortunately, you missed the most recent one, hosted alongside activist Mikey Mercedes, who is a woman, by the way, although I didn't have to tell you that she's a woman because the body positivity people are always women. Can you remember the last time you saw a man's fatness celebrated? When's the last time one of these body positivity fat people was a man? It like never happens because you're still allowed to fat shame men. It's specifically women who have the right to balloon to whatever size they please without any criticism from anybody. So anyway, the seminar was titled Fat Phobia in Public Health and was specifically meant for weight-inclusive dietitians. Of course, the term weight-inclusive dietitian is a bit like the term cancer-inclusive oncologist or cockroach-inclusive pest control. You can't include, that is, support and celebrate, the very thing your job requires you to treat and destroy. So there are many such contradictions in the world of the body positivity activist, many absurdities, and they all culminate in this tweet for Monica. She wrote, quote, "Periodic reminder that treating and preventing obesity actually means trying to conversion therapy fat people into becoming thin people despite zero evidence that this is remotely possible." You heard that right. Monica, the consultant and educator, says that dieting is a form of conversion therapy and moreover that there is zero evidence that dieting actually makes anyone skinnier. Monica believes, or wants you to believe anyway, that caloric intake actually has nothing at all to do with weight. What about all the millions of people who have managed to drop weight by limiting calories? Well, they're all mythological. They don't exist. If you're one of those people, you don't exist, I'm sorry to say. Or else you're part of a grand fat-phobic conspiracy. A conspiracy which includes almost every doctor and nutritionist in the world, by the way. And what about the fact that starving people always tend to be very skinny? So that's a coincidence. And the fact that obesity is only common in Western countries where people eat a lot of food and hardly move. What about the almost complete absence of obesity in the third world? For that matter, what about the fact that our skeletons and internal organs literally were not made to carry the kind of weight that Monica and her fellow fat activists are forcing their skeletons and organs to carry? That's why fat people die young. That's why there are no morbidly obese 85-year-olds. Your body at that age just can't handle it. It can't carry all that weight around anymore. What about that? Don't all of these facts point incontrovertibly to the notion that you get fat when you eat a lot and get skinny when you eat less? No, says Monica. Don't ask her to explain herself either. It makes her feel good to see the world the way she sees it, and your job is to enforce whatever perception of the world and herself makes her feel good. That's your sacred responsibility because she says so. Now, as crazy as all of this is, the most revealing aspect is the way that she uses the term fat people and skinny people. Now, she doesn't mean fat and skinny as a mere description of a transient physical trait. When she says fat people, she does not mean people who happen to have an unhealthy amount of lard on their bodies. No, for her, fat is an immutable and defining characteristic. It's an identity. It's who she is deep inside. It's her very soul is fat. Fatness is an identity. I tell you, we're only months away, since I'm making predictions today on the show, I can also tell you this, we're only months away from somebody coming up with a special pronouns for fat people, which will give a whole new meaning to the term trans fat. And I'm not joking about the pronouns. In our culture, the special pronoun, it's how you affirm and consecrate an identity. It's like a baptism. And the good thing is that the blessed pronouns, though they are supposed to have this mystical significance, can change any time. So just for fun, let's look at another example of this phenomenon, dipping into the TikTok well with the help of our friend Libs of TikTok, who found this one. Here's a woman announcing her new pronouns. Listen to this.
Hey, guys. I think it's finally time for an update on my gender series. I'm not going to lie. I have no idea what part this is, but let's go. Okay, first off, I am now just going by Kay now. I no longer like to be called Kayla unless it's for work, just because it's kind of confusing with the paperwork and stuff, so yeah. I also am now using all pronouns instead of none. I don't regret not going by any pronouns before, but I do feel that that's what's happening. Another thing, though, I'm still xenogender. That is still my gender that I identify with, and I am still bisexual, so those things have not changed at all. So yeah, this is just a little quick update that I have for y'all, and I don't know. Just let me know if you have any questions. I'd love to answer them.
Okay, make sure to update your scoreboard now. Kayla is now Kay. She's still xenogender, whatever that is, but she went from no pronouns to all pronouns. That's the update. Now, how could she have had no pronouns before? Did she not exist? Was she some kind of phantom or something? And how could she go by all pronouns now? What does she really mean, all pronouns? Even like it? Can I call her an it? I suppose so. She is a man, a woman, a thing, a nothing, and everything. She is all things and no things. She transcends time and space. She's like some sort of pantheistic deity. And you better not so much as suggest otherwise, because your job, again, is to affirm. As we've learned, to do anything less than affirm, to express even mild disagreement with a person's self-perception, is to engage in conversion therapy. And conversion therapy is the ultimate sin, because it's an attack on a person's self-identity, which is to say that it's an attack on their entire world, on their reality, because they recognize no world or reality aside from the one they've created in their heads. Now, I want to get a little bit more philosophical here. So let's bring together fat acceptance stuff, pronouns, hysteria about conversion therapy, and all the rest of it. What's really going on? I think what's happening is that we are conscious beings to begin with. We are aware of ourselves, aware of our own fragility and impermanence. And as far as we know, we're the only creatures in the universe cursed with such an awareness. So we find ourselves floating in this vast ocean of existence, wondering about the reason and the purpose for it all. We came from non-existence and will fade back into the abyss from which we came, at least physically. And we know all of that. The only way to survive is to reach out for an anchor point, you know, something stable. Try to find an island to rest on. Because we can't be conscious beings floating along with no purpose and yet aware of it the whole time. We can't do that indefinitely. There's just no way to live. You can't live that way. People who try to live that way end up not living for very long. The problem that we face in the West is that we had an anchor. We had an island, but we abandoned it. We gave up on God, on religion, which was our source of identity, our sense of purpose, our solid ground. We decided that it wasn't good enough for us, so we jumped back into the sea with no real idea of where else to go instead. So now we're adrift, aimless and meandering, and totally susceptible to any storm that comes along. We have no shelter from it, no escape from the crashing waves. What we're witnessing with the proliferation of gender identities, the pronoun madness, the fat acceptance stuff, are a bunch of drowning adrift people reaching out for anchors, for little islands, for some kind of stability and identity, having traded in the one true source of stability and identity available to us. But these anchors aren't really anchors, because they're not anchored in anything. They don't go all the way down to the seafloor. The islands are just driftwood at best. They don't provide the sense of purpose and belonging and worth that these people want from them, which is why they're always trading them out for something else. But really, they're still lost in the sea, hopeless and alone. So I guess it's a good thing that fat people are more buoyant, on second thought. I had a good philosophical thing going there. I ruined it with a fat joke. I should have done that, but I did. In any case, the point is, Monica Crete, the fat acceptance activist, is today canceled. That's all we have for today. Thanks for listening. Talk to you tomorrow. Godspeed.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.
News this hour from townhall.com. I'm Ron Taylor. Canadian Prime Minister Trudeau has flown to Florida to meet with President-elect Donald Trump, who has threatened tariffs against Canada and Mexico, with more correspondent Norman Hall.
Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's visit follows a threat by President-elect Donald Trump to slap sweeping tariffs on Canadian and Mexican products. Trump says the countries must stop what he called the flow of drugs and migrants across the southern and northern borders. Deputy Canadian Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland, speaking in Toronto, says Canada stands by the latest version of the North American Trade Pact.
It is a trade deal that was negotiated by President-elect Donald Trump, which is a further guarantee for all of us.
Blowing up the deal negotiated in Trump's first term in office would be costly to both sides. I'm Norman Hall.
Also at townhall.com, Black Friday gave way to a white weekend in parts of New York State. The first big snow of the season has the potential to bury towns along Lakes Erie and Ontario. During a hectic holiday travel weekend, forecasters warned 4 to 6 feet of blowing and drifting snow could fall in Watertown and other areas of Lake Ontario through Monday. After an unusually mild fall, as much as 2 to 3 feet of lake-effect snow are possible along Lake Erie and south of Buffalo. In Erie County, New York County Executive Mark Palantgers says conditions will be life-threatening without proper precautions.
There are going to be wind chills in the single digits over the next 48 hours. The teens are going to be normal. We haven't experienced cold weather yet, so make sure you're prepared. If you're going out, you have to dress accordingly.
Governor Kathy Hochul has declared a disaster emergency in those areas. Lake effect snow also covered parts of Michigan's Upper Peninsula in a system that is expected to last through the weekend. You'll find more stories, analysis, news, and headlines online at townhall.com. I'm Ron Taylor.
Hi, Mom. Ooh, it's so cold out there. Surprise, I brought you something.
Socks. Oh, Heat Holders Original. Wow, this is so soft and cozy.
Heat Holder socks are the warmest. I use them for snow sports and around the farm. I also bought a bunch for my new work site. The other guys were so jealous they all bought them. And the best part is the socks come in three levels of warmth. Originals, lights, and ultralights.
Oh, Jill can use the ultralights when dog walking. Oh, boy. I know what everyone is getting for gifts this holiday.
Heat Holder socks are the warmest. An independent lab test proved they're 7 times warmer than cotton socks. We use a proprietary 3-stage process, advanced insulating yarn, a long loop thermal pile, and brushed on the inside. This process helps trap warm air closer to your skin longer, keeping your feet warm, comfortable, and dry, making Heat Holders the softest, warmest, and most comfortable socks guaranteed. We also have hats, gloves, throws, and so much more. From now until Cyber Monday, use the code HEAT25 to save 25% off your order. Free shipping for orders over $25. Go to heatholders.com.
Correspondent Lisa Dwyer reports on the passing of a legendary female racing pioneer known as Motorcycle Mary.
Mary McGee had an accomplished racing resume, first in auto racing and later in motorcycle racing. In 1975, she became the first person, man or woman, to complete the grueling Baja 500 off-road race in Mexico solo. McGee's career is highlighted in the short documentary Motorcycle Mary on ESPN's YouTube channel. 7-time Formula One champion Lewis Hamilton was an executive producer for the film. Her family says McGee died at age 87, the day before the documentary was released. I'm Lisa Dwyer.
When you log on to townhall.com, you'll find more breaking news, analysis, headlines, and much more at townhall.com. I'm Ron Taylor reporting. More than 250 Texas prisoners are on a wait list for a special class. With more, here's John Scott.
It's the only class in the state that helps prepare them for life after they're released. Over 6 weeks, students in the Lee College Reentry class will talk about the effects of prison on their mental health, set tangible goals for life after they leave, and learn how to find employment. Lee College services 9 prison units, nearly all of which circle the town of Huntsville. Reentry programs aim to help prisoners make positive life choices during the transition, and research shows they can reduce recidivism and help former inmates join the workforce. John Scott reporting.
3 people have been wounded in a shooting in an Arkansas mall on Black Friday. Little Rock police say the shooting was an isolated incident rather than an active shooter situation. No arrests have been announced. cucumbers shipped to the U.S. and Canada have had an organic eggs sold in 25 Costco and 5 southern states have been recalled because of potential salmonella contamination.
Hello there, this is Kevin Cry. Every other Sunday, I will be on KCNR, your talk radio, 96.5 FM and 1460 AM. I will be discussing the issues that matter to you most. You'll be able to call in directly, ask questions, and have a dialogue, open and free, every other Sunday, right here on KCNR, your talk radio.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. Do you have a crazy schedule and can't seem to get to a class to qualify for your CCW, CCW renewal, or maybe learn to use that new firearm you just purchased? Consider a private class with NFI. Learn to shoot a handgun, rifle, shotgun, or even a BB gun. Classes are taught by an instructor that you choose on your dates and location. Give NFI a call at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and I'll see you at the range.
Turtle Bay's 5th annual Redding Garden of Lights is back for another fun-filled holiday season. Open on select dates from November 22nd through January 5th. Featuring over 10 acres of outdoor illuminated gardens filled with 2 million lights. Don't miss this year's new additions, including new light displays and premium ticket packages. Plus, holiday-themed food, drinks, music, glowing swings, model trains, and much more. Redding Garden of Lights is presented by Mercy Medical Center Redding. Buy tickets now at turtlebay.org.
Want to talk to Santa Claus himself?
Ho, ho, ho! Merry Christmas!
That's right, folks. Santa will be live on the air December 12th from 6:05 to 7 p.m. Tune in to Heroes of the North State, hosted by Michelle Slade of My Umbrella Marketing. Tell Santa your Christmas wishes or just say hi. So mark your calendar for December 12th. Tell a friend and talk to Santa live while making magical memories. Call 530-605-4566 or 530-605-4567.
Bot. Join me for the first Thursday of every month at 6 p.m. for my show, North State Now. In this one-hour show, we cover what's happening in the music scene, theater, food, and arts. We get in-depth interviews with local business owners, musicians, actors, and authors. Listen in, tune in, call in, participate. Win tickets to concerts and theater productions. It's a lot of fun, and believe me, it keeps us going. Join me, your host, Linda Bott, or North State Now, the first Thursday, right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM, also streaming at KCNR1460.com.
Looking for a unique gift this Christmas? Memory Lane Antiques, Vintage and Collectibles in the Shasta Gateway Center on Highway 273 in Anderson has distinct treasures to choose from, including Christmas decorations, vinyl records, DVDs, vintage toys, and antique jewelry, such as brooches and rings, necklaces and bracelets. Memory Lane Antiques, Vintage and Collectibles also offers vintage clothing and accessories, such as retro dresses and scarves, jackets and hats, along with vintage furniture, tablecloths and silverware, cookware and glassware. And don't forget Mantiques, including military memorabilia, camping and mining equipment, men's jewelry such as crosses and rings, sports memorabilia, and collectibles. Come find that perfect gift this Christmas at Memory Lane Antiques, Vintage and Collectibles in the Shasta Gateway Center on Highway 273 in Anderson. Open Monday 10 to 6, closed Tuesday and Wednesday. Open Thursday through Saturday from 10 to 6 and Sunday noon to 5.
Sitting vice president, for God's sakes. This is awful. Like, really, really awful. And she was mad. And what was she mad about? She was mad that at least 30 million people had seen this video.
I just have to remind you, don't you ever let anybody take your power from you.
Yeah, we know. It's the message we've all heard at the bar at 2:30 when they're turning the lights on and tell everybody, you don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. And there's that one person going, don't let anybody take your power from you. So Meghan McCain gets her drawers in a bunch and says, take this down. She's still the sitting vice president, for God's sakes. and 18 million more views were delivered. 18 million more. Talk about not understanding what your actions will do. And it's so wonderful. It's such a Schadenfreude moment for me. Many things to talk about today. I'm not going to spend too much time talking about Black Friday. If you want to go shopping, that's good. And if you're out there, good. It's good for the economy. The economy's good for everybody. If we get everything moving in the right direction in 52 days when Donald Trump is sworn in and the pendulum begins swinging back towards normal. What's that shirt in the Michael, what's that shirt in the Chris Plant store? Remember normal. Yeah, when that pendulum starts swinging back towards normal, then maybe we'll have a little running start. It certainly looks like Donald Trump has a running start. He is naming his cabinet, some critical appointees, and we'll get into some of the craziness that the violent left is trying to foist upon people with their threats, bomb threats. Yeah, Pete Hegseth's family got a visit from police with bomb threats. They called it a credible bomb threat. Credible pipe bomb threat. So the people that warned us about the fascists and the anarchists who didn't respect democracy, well, they've certainly spawned a whole host of threats against potential members of the Trump cabinet. The irony is palpable. We should do irony forecasts in D.C. at least. There should be irony forecasting happening just to show us what's going on. But we'll get into that because earlier this week, before Thanksgiving, it feels like two different weeks, doesn't it? You have Thanksgiving, and then you have Friday afterwards, which it's like a mini week, and then we have a weekend, which is nice. But earlier this week, you had Lieutenant Colonel Alan West, who was making the rounds, and he was talking about Donald Trump's plan to remove all the transgender members of the American military. And the left lost its mind, of course, because you're never going to meet your recruiting quotas. You're never going to meet it. And Colonel West had a great analysis of the whole situation with the trans and how to educate people on what the transgender thing is. He said this is the short version.
If you look down in your pants and you're confused about whether or not you have a choo-choo train or a tunnel, the United States military is not the place for you.
And that's quite simple, clear. And I had a conversation with him, and I'll give you some of the highlights because we talked about that issue of the recruitment of military members and what the banning of transgenders serving in the military would do in terms of how it will help recruiting. And also talked about Donald Trump's selection of Pete Hegseth and where we're going to go in the confirmation of Pete Hegseth, how he feels that's going to happen, and a couple other questions. Looking at some other interesting social issues today, the mainstream media is all upset or obsessed. I'm not sure which one. They might be both. Upset and obsessed with Australia voting to restrict anyone under 16 from having access to social media. Now, Australia's got its own government. It can vote to do whatever it wants, and its people will make those choices. And a lot of folks here are worried about that coming here to America. And I'm stunned by anyone who is freaking out over the ban on social media, anyone who is absolutely losing their mind over the fact that Australia says, no, nobody under 16 should be allowed on social media, but they're okay with them being indoctrinated in schools and in some cases without their parents' permission to be indoctrinated to tell them they can change their gender. It's absolutely amazing. It's great liberal hypocrisy. And we'll dive into that, and I'd love to hear your opinions on that as well. Of course, 888-630-9625 is the number. We also have in the post-football marathon from yesterday, and don't talk to me about my Chicago Bears. We're finding new ways to lose every week. I know it's still painful. But in the Glow from yesterday's football marathon, I'm sitting there saying, wait a minute. We had all of this noise in the past week about the weird ad from Jaguar. That weird ad that didn't feature a car, just featured a bunch of men pretending to be women or something. I don't know what they're, maybe they're pretending to be the Wiggles grown up. A bunch of men in weird all-colored costumes, some of them in dresses, so I guess they were pretending to be women. They were dancing to music in some bizarro fashion show. And then we saw some of the most pro-family, pro-nuclear family, pro-traditional family commercials yesterday during the football games. Were you watching? I was stunned. Right after the Jaguar commercial came out, a lot of people were pointing to a commercial from the Volvo car company that was, it was advertising the technology that Volvo has that makes their cars safe and it helps them avoid accidents. And they did it through the prism of the story of a man and woman who were expecting a child and how that child's life was saved because this Volvo has the technology to stop the car when it senses the driver isn't paying enough attention. And it was a really interesting commercial, and that was literally right after, almost simultaneously, the weird Jaguar ad. And then if you were watching football yesterday, Chevrolet had a tearjerker of a Thanksgiving ad, and it was promoting their trucks, but it was done in a very subtle manner, but it was also promoting family and the connection between a father and a son and a grandfather no longer around. And the conduit to this connection was this Chevy truck. And at the same time, the undercurrent of the commercial, which is really brilliant. It's hard to just play it on radio because it won't make any sense. But the connecting item to these generations was this Chevy truck that Grandpa kept in pristine condition and did his own maintenance and taught the grandson how to do it without the manual. So it was a really interesting commercial, and also in an undercurrent in that commercial was the rejection of the push to have every kid go to college. It was the rest of the family was trying to tell the kid, so where are you going to go to school? Where are you going to go to college, Billy? And the kid didn't want to go. He wanted to work with his hands like Grandpa. It was astounding. Again, Volvo, with their central figures being a nuclear family and talking about a child and respecting and validating, verifying and respecting and honoring the life of the child. Then you have Chevrolet talking not just about that three-generation tie between Grandpa, Dad, and son, grandson, but not pushing the college agenda. And then on top of that, there was a remarkable commercial from Apple. And I don't know if you saw it. It's a tearjerker. It's a commercial for their earbuds, the latest ones. And Apple has apparently developed technology inside their latest earbuds. If I'm saying it wrong, tell me. AirPods, whatever they are. The things you put in your ear so you can listen to your phone. That also has not just noise cancellation like they all do, but they have developed a hearing aid function so that you can wear these little white things in your ear, and they also function as a pretty respectable hearing aid. And that story is built around a family where dad is watching his young daughter grow up and finally being able to hear what she's saying. Unbelievable that in the wake of the madness of the weird, wacky, anti-family, anti-normal people, yes, normal, Jaguar ad, are these three major companies who appear to be saying, okay, we get it. We understand. There's a shift in the culture. And it's back to normal. It's back to nuclear families. It's back to mommies, daddies, children, and family. And I, for one, am on board for all of this. If you've seen it and you understand it, you're welcome to talk about it. If you want to refute what I'm saying, you're also welcome. 888-630-9625. A lot on the plate today, and we hope you'll be here for all of it. It's Mike Opelka in for Chris Plant on The Chris Plant Show.
This is The Chris Plant Show.
Did you know that more strokes occur between November and February? The holidays can be a time of stress, disrupted routines, and overindulgence. But this holiday season, you can do something so easy to manage your heart health. CardioMobile 6L is a small medical-grade personal EKG device that records right to your phone. It records six lead EKGs, that's more than any smartwatch, and it's FDA cleared to check for AFib, a leading cause of stroke. Now, I know you're probably thinking, who can afford that? The answer is, you can. It records more heart data than any smartwatch at a fraction of the cost. And now, for a limited time, you can get the CardioMobile 6L for its lowest price ever, just $99. Better gift for yourself or for a loved one this holiday season. And for just $99, there's no better time. So go to Cardia.com, that's K-A-R-D-I-A.com, or Amazon and order your CardioMobile 6L today. Sponsored by AliveCore.
Hello, everyone. It's your favorite president, Donald J. Trump, here to introduce something really special. You're going to love it. My new Trump watches. It's one of the best watches made. Wear it proudly on your wrist, and everyone will know what it's for, who it's for, what it represents. Get your Trump watch right now. Go to GetTrumpWatches.com. It's Trump time.
That's right. President Trump has won the election, and now he's released his official Trump watches. Celebrate this historic victory with a Trump watch that stands for strength, leadership, and winning. But don't wait, because these limited edition watches won't be around for long. Go to GetTrumpWatches.com now to get your Trump watch before they're gone. Don't miss your chance to own a piece of history. Go now to GetTrumpWatches.com and get your watch today.
This ad paid for by the Best Watches on Earth, LLC. See GetTrumpWatches.com for details. Trump watches are not intended for investment purposes.
Go to GetTrumpWatches.com for our Black Friday sale going on now.
Folks, the unprecedented conviction of former President Donald Trump has thrown our nation into uncharted territory. Trust me, things are going to get worse before they get better. The political turmoil and uncertainty ahead could have severe consequences for our economy and financial markets. But in times of crisis, there is always opportunity. Right now, I see that opportunity in gold. As political tensions rise and the dollar's future becomes uncertain, gold has the potential to reach new heights. That's why I trust Advantage Gold. They're the experts in helping Americans safeguard their wealth with precious metals. Call them today at 800-900-8000 to get their free 2024 gold and silver kit, plus a special Jason Hansen discount with up to $1,300 if you qualify. While the future is certainly unpredictable, your financial security doesn't have to be. Call Advantage Gold now at 800-900-8000 for your discount and bonus. Again, 800-900-8000. Performance may vary. Consult your financial and tax professional.
One in four Americans have a disability. I'm one of them. I'm also a working mom who cares deeply about making sure every child with a disability thrives by getting their access needs met. We've got a trusted ally by our side. Easter Seals provides children and families the foundation for lifelong success through early learning programs, skills training, and prep for college and career. That's my Easter Seals. Make it yours. Join us at EasterSeals.com.
Do you have over $10,000 in credit card debt? If you're feeling the financial impact with unprecedented economic challenges, DebtLou is here for you. With DebtLou's success guarantee, you pay nothing unless your debt is reduced or completely resolved.
I'm just living sky high right now. I'm very thankful for it, and the team at DebtLou are phenomenal. They're able to work with you. They're great.
Call for your free debt resolution information now. 800-200-6895. 800-200-6895.
Are you paying too much for term life insurance? A man age 50 non-tobacco user can obtain $500,000 of coverage for as little as $110 per month. Level rate for 20 years. That's right, guaranteed level rate for 20 years. If you're a smoker, there are great rates available for you as well. Call Term Busters for a quote. 1-800-908-7636. You're probably paying more than you should. Call 1-800-908-7636. Remember, call Term Busters. 1-800-908-7636. Sample rate for preferred non-tobacco rate class. Exam required to qualify.
Do you have a special needs child or an older adult in your home? The risk of them leaving the house unnoticed is real and terrifying. But you can protect your loved ones with Vivint Home Security. Right now, Vivint is offering a free doorbell camera with any new plan, plus free installation and low monthly monitoring plans. Call 800-953-6693. That's 800-953-6693. Monthly service agreement required for free installation.
Welcome to Friday on the Chris Plant Show. Mike Opelka in for my friend Chris Plant. Hope you had a great Trumpsgiving, a great Thanksgiving. If you were not able to call it Trumpsgiving in your home, we were, because it was just my wife and I. So I hope you were as fortunate to have a cool, calm, and collected Thanksgiving dinner. Many people I know did. It's overblown by the media. I really think they're trying to separate us. And I really think we're not going to allow that to happen. I saw some of the scenes at Mar-a-Lago yesterday where the Trump family was joined by the Musk family, Elon Musk and his mama May. And, Tiffany Trump was there. Barron Trump was there. Melania, of course, was there. Sylvester Stallone was there. There was some joke telling between Sylvester Stallone and Elon Musk. One can only wonder. I just wonder how long it's going to take for the left to find a picture where Donald Trump is with either only the boys, Elon Musk and Sylvester Stallone and Barron, and say Melania was suspiciously absent from Thanksgiving. No, you could see them walking in together. And there's even a little YMCA Trump dancing going on, which is obviously being seen everywhere. This incoming administration appears to be gaining more and more momentum. We're going to talk about some of the reactions to the proposals of Donald Trump's tax tariffs on Mexico, Canada, and China, and how the left is absolutely apoplectic, especially the left side of the mainstream media, telling you that it's going to destroy so many industries in America. Well, that's only if the targeted countries don't comply. If you don't do that, well, then you get hit with the tariffs. So there are things to talk about. And in that level, we'll talk about that. I also want to get into, we didn't have a lot of time here, the bomb threats that I mentioned earlier. The bomb threats to some of Donald Trump's appointees, potential cabinet members, especially Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth. And now the left is saying, hey, we've got bomb threats too, and we're going to have a complete investigation of this. Well, welcome to the party, pal. And it's interesting to me that your threats happened very much after the threats to all of these Republicans happened. But if you call people Nazis and fascists for a long enough time, you're eventually going to trip a trigger in somebody out there who's going to try and do something awful. So maybe you take a little responsibility for the rhetoric. Perhaps you take just a little bit of responsibility for what you've been saying and doing for the last 8 years as it relates to Donald Trump. And if you want to talk about toning down the rhetoric, you might start with your own rhetoric volume level. Like I said, we have a lot to get to today. There's good news today, too. Have you seen the videos out of Paris with the reopening of the cathedral at Notre Dame? Boy, does it look stunning. They spent $750 million to get it built back, and it seems like it was built back in record time. They're going to get a lot of folks come to visit. But we'll talk more about Thanksgiving, Trump's giving at Mar-a-Lago. Zuckerberg showed up. Huh. I wonder what that's all about. We'll share. It's Opelka in for Plant on The Chris Plant Show.
You're listening to The Chris Plant Show.
Happy holidays from our home helpers family to yours. At Home Helpers, we are proud to help your loved ones celebrate this holiday season from the safety and comfort of their own homes. We are equally proud of the men and women who can't be with us. To the bravest among us, far from home serving our country this holiday season, to all members of the military in all branches, past and present, and those who made the ultimate sacrifice, with respect, gratitude, and love, we thank you. Happy holidays from all of us at Home Helpers. Life takes you to unexpected places. Love brings you home.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
KCNR 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and KCNR1460.com has teamed up with Michelle Slade from My Umbrella Marketing, the Turtle Bay Exploration Park, and Black Bear Diner at 2605 Hilltop Drive to help out Toys for Tots this holiday season and give you a chance to win some great prizes, including 4 tickets to the Turtle Bay Garden of Lights and $50 in gift certificates, better known as Black Bear Bucks from Black Bear Diner. All you have to do to get into our drawing is donate a brand new unwrapped toy valued at $10 or more to the KCNR studios at 1326 Market Street in downtown Reading. Then your name goes into a drawing coming up December 12th at 8:15 a.m. with Carl and Linda Bott during Free Fire Radio on KCNR. Teaming up with Michelle Slade from My Umbrella Marketing, the Turtle Bay Garden of Lights, and Black Bear Diner to help out Toys for Tots this Christmas. And giving you a chance to win some great prizes on KCNR. No purchase necessary to enter the drawing. 1 entry per person. Join Shasta College Saturday and Sunday, December 7th and 8th from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Shasta College Farm for their annual Country Christmas Fair and Tree Sale. They have a wide variety of trees to choose from. And come and get your Christmas shopping done early with handcrafted gifts, plus proceeds will benefit Shasta College students. In addition to shopping, you can enjoy the free family fun activities with a bounce house for the kids and a petting zoo, too. It's all happening at the Shasta College Farm. Bring 6 non-perishable canned food items and receive $3 off 1 tree. Canned food will be donated to the Good News Rescue Mission.
Riverfront Playhouse presents Gaslight Theater's Christmas Vacation by Katherine Burns and Mike Urema, with musical arrangements by Josh Lamoureux, directed by Aaron Stewart. See this delightful musical comedy set in a small town where Mark Grinsworth aims to create the ultimate Christmas for his family while maintaining his streak in the annual Holiday Lights contest. Tickets available at riverfrontplayhouse.net. Gaslight Theater's Christmas Vacation, November 29th through December 15th. Sponsored by this station and these pro arts businesses.
Now is a great time to prepare for the upcoming wildfire season. REU and city staff are busy clearing vegetation to mitigate wildfire risk to our power lines, facilities, and the community. You can also prepare by trimming back shrubs and tree branches that are closer than 5 feet from your home. Clear debris from your roof and gutter and clear dead vegetation on your property. For information about tree trimming and proximity to power lines, call 530-224-4356. Please remember, we all need to work together to prevent wildfires in our community.
Looking for work? O2 Employment Services has been working with local job seekers for the past 20 years. If you're tired of uploading your resume and getting no response, it's time to let O2 help you find that perfect position. Oh, and by the way, you pay absolutely nothing for our service. If you'd like our help, head on over to our website at o2es.com, click apply now, and complete our online application. We have connections with over 600 local businesses. Once we have your information and understand what you're looking for, we can introduce you to all the positions you may wish to consider. We currently have over 100 available positions, and we would love to match you with the one you're looking for. O2 Employment Services, the North State's leading staffing agency. Give us a call at 530-223-4674. That's 530-223-4674. Or visit us online at o2es.com.
At Stifel Nicolaus, I am committed to offering investors personalized investment guidance. Stifel is a full-service organization with department staff with professionals that specialize in a wide range of investment opportunities. We strive to give each account, regardless of size, careful individual attention. This is Financial Advisor Susan Eastman at 530-244-7199. Let's talk today about a personalized plan. Again, that number, 530-244-7199.
The property insurance crisis in California is starting to affect the business insurance property also. 200 to 300% rate increases in business property rates or not writing business insurance at all are becoming the norm. At Siskiyou Insurance, we have over 100 years experience in writing business insurance in the North State. We can help. We live here and care about our community and want to make sure that you keep your business with a local agent that knows our town and supports it every day. And we'll get you the best deal we can. Call Curtis Byron at Siskiyou Insurance Services, 530-224-2345 or 1-800-773-2345. Siskiyou Insurance, 530-224-2345 or 1-800-773-2345.
Hi, this is Chuck Kenny, owner of Shasta Gas Propane. 27 years ago, my wife Judy and I started Shasta Gas with the help and under the direction of the Lord Jesus Christ. In fact, we believe He is the owner and we are simply the managers. Through the years, we have received many offers from major national corporations to buy Shasta Gas, but our commitment has always been to be and remain locally owned and family operated. Our daughter Karen Wehunt and her husband Jason now manage the daily operations of Shasta Gas and Shasta Tanks, a new business we started a few years ago. We now have the third generation of family members working in the business. Sunshine Stevens, our granddaughter, and her husband Adam, and our grandson Jason. Our commitment and motto are still the same. Our customers are warm friends. To support locally owned family operated business, please call Shasta Gas Propane at 530-365-3793. That's 530-365-3793.
Join Shasta College Saturday and Sunday, December 7th and 8th from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Shasta College Farm for their annual Country Christmas Fair and Tree Sale. They have a wide variety of trees to choose from. And come and get your Christmas shopping done early with handcrafted gifts, plus proceeds will benefit Shasta College students. In addition to shopping, you can enjoy the free family fun activities with a bounce house for the kids and a petting zoo, too. It's all happening at the Shasta College Farm. Bring 6 non-perishable canned food items and receive $3 off one tree. Canned food will be donated to the Good News Rescue Mission.
Elon-like or Zuckerberg-like or an amalgamation of the two. We will see. Good thinking there, Thomas. I appreciate you. Thank you, sir. We will see. And as mentioned, Zuckerberg showed up. Mark Zuckerberg, who, if we go back in time to the 2020 election, a lot of people believe Zuckerberg spent $400+ million of his own dollars to influence the election. And I actually believe it may have even been more. He certainly used Facebook and some of the tweaking of the algorithms on Facebook to alter the accessibility to certain posts, meaning he was pushing down posts that were supportive of Trump or more conservative issues and elevating those that were more liberal and supporting Biden. I think it's a reasonable assessment. But now that Zuckerberg was spotted at Mar-a-Lago, tongues are wagging in the media. Even one of the creepier tongues in the media. I'm talking about Mark Halperin, who was on Newsmax talking about Zuckerberg at showing up at Mar-a-Lago. Here's what he had to say.
According to my sources, although there were chairs at the dinner table, Mark Zuckerberg bent a knee.
Bent a knee. That's a little bit of a shot to Zuckerberg, isn't it? Bent a knee. And why? Why would he bend a knee, Mark Halperin?
Because any CEO now knows that Donald Trump is the new sheriff in town, and they want to be on as good terms as possible. These two have had an on-again, off-again relationship. And I think it's pretty clear that flying to Mar-a-Lago, one of the richest people in the world, one of the most influential on social media, to come to Mar-a-Lago to try to mend fences and talk about a common agenda, the Trump people are being very gracious about it. But my suspicion is Donald Trump is smiling a little bit by the virtue of what's happening all around him, which is world CEOs want to be part of his administration now.
Yeah. They want to be part of the club.
Mark Halperin is a political
analyst. Hang on there, Newsmaxer. Yeah, they want to be part of the club. They don't want to be shut out. They've had access to the White House for a considerable time now. And we all know prior to the first Trump administration, we talked about this censorship of people on the right. And we talked about the elevation of people on the left. And we talked about what initially went on inside Twitter before Elon Musk purchased it. How Jack Dorsey's Twitter was really an arm of the government in many ways, with weekly meetings. Things have changed. And you have to wonder if Zuckerberg isn't waking up going, the Doge thing could have problems for us. It might cut out some of our friendly government agencies that we're connected to. And let's face it, he doesn't want to be blocked by the White House. And the other end of this, and I'd like to know how you feel about it. There is a discussion that has everybody at CNN freaking out and many people at MSNBC freaking out. The discussion is that this White House under Donald John Trump will be giving press credentials to members of the podcasting class, to people that stream instead of they are part of the legacy media. They're not part of, say, the CNN, NBC, MSNBC, Fox News even. And New York Times, the Associated Press. They're talking about granting access to the White House press room to people like Joe Rogan, to people like Tucker Carlson, to people who have a substantial audience that the traditional media does not have. And that has the left freaking out. And I'm all in on that. Look, it should be based on the ability to get the message out to the American people. If you have the numbers, you should have access. If we're looking at some of the networks, MSNBC and CNN both have seen precipitous drops in their ratings since the election because a lot of people, well, first of all, they just might have had election exhaustion. But many other people in the course of that have realized they were lied to. They were told a big lie about Donald Trump. Just look at what the mea maxima culpa from Morning Joe has done to their reputation. The fact that they went down to Mar-a-Lago and they too bent a knee and told Donald Trump, gee, we'd like to make sure we have a connection to you, a channel to you. After they called him a Nazi, they called him a fascist, they said he was a threat to democracy. Their audience is furious. So if their audience is smaller than some of the streaming audiences, shouldn't those streaming audiences have access to that press room? I believe it's fair. And isn't fairness what it's all about? I see an opinion coming in here from one of our regulars talking about the visit of Mark Zuckerberg at Mar-a-Lago. Jason's in Kensington. Hello, Jason. Happy Thanksgiving to you.
Hey, happy Thanksgiving, mate. How you doing?
I'm good. Jason, does Australia have a Thanksgiving celebration?
No, we don't. No, we don't. It's definitely a truly American tradition. But I, you know what, I don't mind it at all. It's what I'll indulge in, that's for sure, as I did last night. I'm sort of feeling it this morning. But,
no, that's okay.
But, yeah, but all these people that are popping up, all of a sudden becoming sort of friendly with the president. I mean, the old saying is keep your friends close and your enemies closer. Hopefully Trump is sort of weighing in on that and just hoping that he knows what these people tried to do to him the last 8 years or so. I mean, these fair-weather friends, of course, it's all about the money and the audience. And if I'm a Democratic voter, I would be pretty mad with both the media and my own party that... But then again, if you have a mind to do your own research, which a lot of them don't, you would have found all this stuff out, you know, would have known the truth back at the outset. I mean, why would you tag along with these people that are just absolute frauds?
Well, if we go back a couple of years, and somewhere I have the clip, Mika Brzezinski was on her show telling people that we are the ones who tell you what to think about something.
Exactly. I remember that. I remember that bunch. You know, just look at it. Just what way we think is the way you should think. And, I mean, you've got to be, yeah, you've got to be a little bit sort of, I mean, it's funny because a lot of these people are pretty educated. I mean, I wouldn't say I'm the most educated guy out there, but I sort of know when I'm getting led up the garden path, you know.
Well, it's easy once it's all exposed. You know, once they start telling the truth, or once people start hearing the truth, you start looking back at the people who are telling you lies and go, wait a minute, we're not idiots, and you should no longer expect us to support you once we realize you've been lying to us. And I think that garden path has a lot of traffic these days from people who turned around and they're walking back the other way. It's amazing. Hey, you know, maybe the keep your friends close and your enemies closer thing is also in the minds of Zuckerberg as well.
Exactly.
He might have gone down there to find out just exactly what's going on, not just with Trump, but with Elon Musk.
Yeah. You know, as I say, keep all the options on the table, because, like I said, I wouldn't trust these people as far as I could kick them. Yeah,
it's an interesting game to watch. This is a great dance to watch, and I, for one, am here for all of it, and we'll be watching every bit of it. Thank you, Jason. Appreciate you being there. If you're still a little stuffed, you know, add a couple more reps today, maybe stretch one more mile on your road work when you're out there today. It's a good day to get out there. It's not too hot, not too cold. Push it, man. Push it. He doesn't care. The reality that Australia doesn't have, I should have asked him about Australia banning social media for kids under 16. That's a topic I want to get into today and see where you stand on all of this. I think it's a fascinating little bit of a reaction from a country that's had a lot of overreaction in the past. Look at what Australia did around firearms. Look at what they did around the pandemic. And you only need to see that they are prone to severe knee-jerk on several topics. So we will get into that. The other story I promised I will get to it is the discussion of the threats to all of these appointees to Donald Trump's administration. And they seem to be building. And now the Democrats are saying, we've got threats too, and we want a full investigation. Yeah, well, there should be a threat investigation, or an investigation on every threat to every elected member. Every single one. And so let's not wait till the Democrats get nominated. There also is a story that may be the biggest angry response from any elected member of the New York legislation. And it's about leaving the country. You know, we've talked about the celebrities any celebrity, Cher, Sharon Stone, who we need to talk about her in Italy as well. All these people who said they're going to leave, Taylor Swift, Ellen DeGeneres, and her other half have already left. All these people who said they've left. Now there is a movement from a member of the Democrat Party who wants the entire state, her entire state, and a couple others to join together and leave the United States. They don't want all the people to leave. they want to break up with us. And it's an interesting poll that we should put out there. Would you care if we lost New York State, Vermont, New Hampshire, and Massachusetts? Would you even care? We'll explain the obligatory Chris Plant Show air quotes with my fingers here. Would you understand the logic, in air quotes, behind this idea? It's almost laughable to me, but yet it's out there and it's in the public and she's not hiding it. I also wonder what Canada thinks because, you know, they probably would have a say in this. Very interesting. The number to join the conversation, 888-630-9625. It's Mike Opelka in for Chris Plant on The Chris Plant Show.
He could have undermined the messaging so much that he can actually control exactly what people think. And that is our job.
Yeah. This is The Chris Plant Show.
This holiday season, if long days on your feet are wearing you down, remember, hardworking Americans deserve better than pain slowing them down. For those who keep this country moving forward, G-Defy shoes deliver on comfort and support. With patented VersaShock technology, G-Defy helps absorb impact, helps support your posture, and gives energy back with every step. Listen, the nice people at G-Defy sent a pair of their shoes to me and a pair for my best girl. We really love our G-Defy shoes, and we get out and hike around the city, you know. We hike around the city with our G-Defy shoes, and when we finish hiking around the city, our feet feel better than they felt before we started hiking around the city. Visit G-Defy.com and use the code Chris for 50% off your order of $100 or more. That's code Chris for 50% off your order of $100 or more at GDEFY.com. Stand strong and step comfortably this holiday season. That's GDEFY.com.
Hello, everyone. It's your favorite president, Donald J. Trump, here to introduce something really special. You're going to love it. My new Trump watches. It's one of the best watches made. Wear it proudly on your wrist, and everyone will know what it's for, who it's for, what it represents. Get your Trump watch right now. Go to GetTrumpWatches.com. It's Trump time.
That's right. President Trump has won the election, and now he's released his official Trump watches. Celebrate this historic victory with a Trump watch that stands for strength, leadership, and winning. But don't wait, because these limited edition watches won't be around for long. Go to GetTrumpWatches.com now to get your Trump watch before they're gone. Don't miss your chance to own a piece of history. Go now to GetTrumpWatches.com and get your watch today.
This ad paid for by the Best Watches on Earth, LLC. See GetTrumpWatches.com for details. Trump watches are not intended for investment purposes.
Go to GetTrumpWatches.com for our Black Friday sale going on now.
Do you have over $10,000 in credit card debt? The stress from excessive credit card debt can ruin your life. Collection calls, sleepless nights. If you're feeling the financial impact with unprecedented economic challenges, DebtLu is here for you. DebtLu uses secret programs that most credit card companies won't tell you about. They'll help you consolidate or settle your debts for a fraction of what you owe. With DebtLu's success guarantee, you pay nothing unless your debt is reduced or completely resolved. There's no risk. The more you owe, the more DebtLu can save you. See how easy it is to get started with free information. Let DebtLu show you how 10 minutes could save you thousands. Call now, 800-200-6895. That's 800-200-6895.
I'm just living sky high right now. I'm very thankful for it, and the team at DebtLu are phenomenal. They're able to work with you. They're great.
Call for your free debt resolution information now, 800-200-6895. 800-200-6895.
Do you have a special needs child or an older adult in your home? The risk of them leaving the house unnoticed is real and terrifying. But you could protect your loved ones with Vivint Home Security.
Alarm on.
Our child has autism. He doesn't usually elope, but one day he did, and it was the most terrifying moment of our lives.
If I didn't have a home security system, I would have realized way too late he's gone.
Right now, Vivint is offering a free doorbell camera with any new plan, plus free installation and low monthly monitoring plans. Smart locks, lights, cameras, and more make Vivint Home Security the smartest way to protect your family and prevent a tragedy. Vivint is the number one smart home service provider in the U.S. Protection is just a phone call away. Call 800-953-6693. That's 800-953-6693. Monthly service agreement required for free installation.
Individuals and businesses with tax problems, listen carefully. If you owe over $10,000 in back taxes or have unfiled tax returns, U.S. Tax Shield can help you take back control. The IRS can seize your bank accounts, garnish your paycheck, close your business, and file criminal charges. Our team of tax attorneys can stop collections and get you protected. U.S. Tax Shield offers a price protection guaranteed quote to get you protected today. U.S. Tax Shield is A-plus rated with the BBB, so call 800-466-9625. U.S. Tax Shield, 800-466-9625.
Are you paying too much for term life insurance? A man age 50 non-tobacco user can obtain $500,000 of coverage for as little as $110 per month. Level rate for 20 years. That's right, guaranteed level rate for 20 years. If you're a smoker, there are great rates available for you as well. Call Term Busters for a quote. 1-800-908-7636. You're probably paying more than you should. Call 1-800-908-7636. Remember, call Term Busters. 1-800-908-7636. Sample rate for preferred non-tobacco rate class. Exam required to qualify.
And welcome to the Chris Plant Show. Mike Opelka, that's me, back in for my buddy Chris Plant on this Black Friday. Breaking news. If you were expecting an Amazon delivery today, I'm not sure if it will be on time. Just saw ABC News reporting Amazon global strike on Black Friday. Make Amazon pay day. Workers for the big online retailer all over the world on a strike today. And they say expect protests, actions in 20 countries, including here in the U.S., in some of the big cities. I know we're on a first name basis with our UPS driver. I don't know any of the Amazon drivers, but we get a lot of stuff delivered. But they're expecting protests in major cities here in the U.S., Germany, the U.K., Japan, India, Brazil, and more. And it could go through Cyber Monday. Timing is right, right? We saw the Charlotte airport workers decide to go on strike earlier this week, as was the busiest travel week in the history of travel weeks. So that's what you do if you're a union. We'll see if there's a change. I know there are myriad stories of how difficult it is to be one of the workers inside one of the Amazon centers. And it's not all robots doing the jobs. So we'll monitor that and see if there's any progress to it. I mentioned the opportunity that this one angry Democrat from New York, a state senator, Liz Krueger, is taking. Liz Krueger, really mad that Donald Trump is going to be the president and that the GOP will retain control of the House, even though it's a slim control, but have a substantial advantage in the Senate. So what does she want to do? She wants to take her ball and leave. She wants to get out, but she's not going to walk.
One New York state senator is even floating the idea of having New York withhold federal taxes and then the Empire State seceding to join Canada.
Instead of us all trying to illegally cross the border at night without them noticing, which is pretty hard because there's lots of us, that they should instead agree to let us be the Southeast Province, a new province of Canada. New York, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Vermont would combine and be a great new province as the Southeast Province of Canada. Basically, everybody in these states are progressive Democrats who would fit in pretty well with the political philosophy of at least most of the Canadian elected officials. Well, in a new interview with Politico, State Senator Krueger, who chairs the powerful State Senate Finance Committee, also says that her state and the others should stop sending tax money to the federal government as part of their protest. New York State's controller says if the Empire State sends more than $361 billion a year or provides 6.5% of the whole federal budget.
So New York stomping its feet, demanding demanding that they be allowed to join Canada. And we're going to bring along the massholes, and we'll bring along the people of Vermont, and we'll bring along the people of New Hampshire. Really? Really? You think that's going to fly? It's so funny. They promised they would leave, and now they just want their states to secede. You might look at the way the medical industry runs in Canada, the healthcare industry. You might look at the Second Amendment in Canada. You might look at the way entertainment is handled in Canada as well. I love it when these people just get mad and they're stomping their feet like an 8-year-old in a cereal aisle who wants that box of tricks because there's a toy inside. All right, so much more to get to. It's Opelka in for Chris Plant on The Chris Plant Show.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.